everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have the usual crew here. We have Josh Torres.
Hello. Hi.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
I survived.
And Chao Min Wu.
Yes.
Yes. We are recording this a little over a week into November. It is the 9th at the time of recording. We've all fallen back last week, getting used to very early sunsets and heading into colder seasons. It just snowed where I'm at for the first time just a couple days ago. So it really feels like that time of year kind of creeped up on us, but here we are. And of course, we've had a lot of video games releasing. And this week, we had another one that we just put up a review for that some people have had circled on their calendar. Some people have been mildly interested in seeing how this one turns out, and that is a new entry in the Mario and Luigi RPG series. This is Mario and Luigi Brothership. This was announced at the summer Nintendo Direct around the E3 Summer Games Fest timeframe. This is obviously a bit of a surprise because it's the first Mario and Luigi game for a console. Of course, Alpha Dream, the previous developer, is no longer. We learned after the fact that Brothership was being helmed by primarily Acquire, which we have seen supporting some of Square Enix's projects previously. So kind of an interesting cross-threading of talent there.
As an aside, Acquire is now owned by Kadokawa.
Who owns From Software, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I need to look into it, but Kadokawa actually just put out their financials, and they basically seems like they're going to let Acquire kind of basically make console games and do their own thing, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with them. So,
but yeah, and we have Dragon Quest next week, but this week we're going to focus on Brothership. So we have a review up on the site helmed by Adam here. So we're going to give the microphone over to him first off to talk about his time with Brothership. And Adam, I believe you've played basically every other game in the series, including every remake. I'm not sure if there's one that you've missed.
That's true.
So you've done the DS. Can you? I almost forget them. The Superstar, Partners in Time, Bowser's Inside, Dream Team. Am I missing one?
Paper Jam.
And you're also missing Superstar Saga and Bowser's Minions.
And then yeah, Bowser's Inside Story and Bowser's Junior's.
Bowser Junior's Journey.
Yeah.
I played both of those. Adam, right? Yes. I reviewed both of those,
Sometimes we go into a review and we get a new perspective. We get someone who's just coming in off the boat and they're fresh. But this time, like, no, we're giving it to the guy who was most qualified.
I remember when I first started writing here, it was right around the time that, like, Etrian Odyssey Nexus was coming out. And Adam, wasn't it that you, like, played through the entire Etrian Odyssey series in the span of, like, 6 weeks or something?
Yeah. And that includes 1, 2, 3, 4. Was 5 out by then? I forget.
Yeah, 5 out. Nexus was after 5.
And then also Millennium Girl and Fafnir Knight. So 7 games now, in 6 weeks.
Now, I don't think I have to tell this to anyone listening to this podcast, but if you're not familiar with Etrian Odyssey somehow, it has been a while. It has been a while. You should just know that I'm pretty sure Adam did not sleep.
No.
But anyways, maybe Adam didn't have to take a similar tack for this one because he's just kept up to date on the series ever since Superstar Saga back in the mid-2000s, whenever that was. But Brothership, of course, like I said, this was kind of a new entry in a series that has never really set the world on fire, but I know a lot of people have really fond memories of. I know Superstar Saga kind of was one of those quintessential RPGs for the GBA. Some of the other games, like I think Bowser's Inside Story, usually is really well regarded. So Brothership is kind of a different beast. So you went firsthand on hand with it, and just tell us about your time with it and how it compares, what's new, what's different, what's the same, and how you feel about it.
Yeah, so 11 years ago, I wrote my first review for RPG Site in September of 2013, I think. And it was for Mario & Luigi Dream Team, which is the fourth entry in the series. And reading my old review, one of my very first reviews, more than 100 reviews ago, my takeaway was more or less, this is a well-made game. It's got some creative, components to it. It's got the usual quirkiness and, charm and energy that we kind of expect from the Mario & Luigi series. But it was too damn long which was kind of surprising coming off like the previous games in the series, like Bowser's Inside Story and Superstar Saga and Dream Team. Those are all like 20, 25 hours long. They're pretty short for RPGs. Sorry, I might have misspoke on title there, but the first three games in the series are all relatively short. Dream Team, being the fourth entry in the series, was roughly around 40 hours, which I know there are plenty of RPGs that are longer than that in general that are excellent, but for a Mario and Luigi game, and for this one specifically, it was just like too long. It dragged, everything took forever. There was a lot of tutorials, a lot of just like meandering.
Also, all the padding, like yes. Every single Dream, like Luigi section, you would start off and it would be like one screen away. It's like, oh, that's what we need. And then it's like, psych, it's all the way over here. Spend 2-3 hours to get to it and then do a very annoying Dream Luigi segment. It's like,
yeah. And playing through Brothership, which is, what, the sixth game in the series, technically, not including remakes. Starting out, you know, I enjoyed, like, I accept the transition into 3D. I like the sprites. I'm always a fan of sprites. But as far as, like, translating the style of the game into, like, three-dimensionals just in terms of how it looks, I'm fine with it. There are some things that I'm a little bit less positive on. Like, for example, there's this blue shading that's used throughout that gets a little bit confusing with the colors. But anyways, you know, I'm fine with how it looks. There are other criticisms I'll get to. But as I kept playing through this game, I kept getting this kind of lingering feeling of deja vu. Like, oh no, this is starting to drag and this is starting to like meander a bit. And this is starting to like feel like it's taking too long. And it's kind of circuitous in terms of what it's trying to do. And then I realized, oh my, and this is starting to feel like Dream Team again. And that is just too damn long. And by the end of the game, I was like, yeah, that's my main takeaway overall as a criticism, is this, that the game is too long. And for some hard numbers, for me, I actually did tick over 50 hours. Now, that's a little bit slow because I was doing some note-taking, as I normally do when I play games for reviews and things like that. So I was estimating around, okay, 45 hours or so. And I know I was reading some other reviews like Inverse and Destructoid. Those are also in like the 40-hour range, 40 to 45-hour range. So that's roughly what we're getting at, although I did see some under 40 hours. But still, roughly 40 hours is what we're looking at here. And I just feel like these sorts of games just aren't well suited for that length. They don't have the same sorts of like progression that you see in other RPGs where you're getting new characters or new skills or equipment or something that kind of keeps things fresh. I just feel like Mario and Luigi games don't really support that as well. You're oftentimes using the same abilities in the same ways, battle after battle. The storylines are less serious, more quirky, but as soon as you start to drag that out, they kind of become more tedious than anything else. And in the end, I just kind of feel like every component of this game kind of felt like it took about 25% longer than it should, from battles to the scenarios to how many battles to how long they are to the how many islands there are. I believe it was actually the Destructoid review that kind of put it this way, where it feels like the game is reaching its climax and then it tries to maintain that for like the next 5-10 hours. And it's like, don't do this. This is the first game that's for a console in the series. So I think it's the first game that's $60. And a part of me is wondering, maybe they felt when developing this game that it needed to be like a certain length to be enticing to would-be purchasers in terms of, you know, they're going to be spending their money on this. They want to get their money's worth. But
yeah,
still,
I started getting. Yeah, I played a good chunk of this. I didn't complete it, but I started getting that creeping feeling of like, oh man, this is going to like really drag out. When, yeah, you know, like in every Mario and Luigi, you usually have like secondary resources besides your HP bar. So like your effectively your MP bar. And then, like, you don't even interact with that bar at all for, like, the first 3.5 to 4 hours. You don't start getting, like, your first thing to expend that MP bar until that far in. And, like, oh, my God, this is going to take a while. This is taking way too long to, like, get the dice rolling. Like the tutorialization in this game is just, it's slow.
And that's the same how I felt for Dream Team.
Yeah. One thing I noticed looking at gameplay is that even the basic attacks now are almost like, for example, the bros attacks from Superstar, and that they take a bit longer, right? Because you have the, it's like, I saw that, and it's like, that I wonder how much that's like kind of impacting the pacing.
Yeah, and I just kind of feel like I would rather it be kind of more short to the point, more energetic. And I think the story stuff, which I understand, no one comes to like Mario and Luigi games for like a dramatic, epic, heart-wrenching, you know, unforgettable narrative. But, you know, like you usually come for something kind of cute, charming, maybe fun. And I kind of feel like this game almost gets too serious by the end. It's just like, it's still like relatively easily digestible. It's still, you know, obviously an all ages type of game, but it's just like, man, this is, I think, going a little bit too deep into what I kind of expect out of Mario and Luigi. And that tied in with all the other pacing stuff we mentioned. It just was a drag. By the end, I was ready for it to be over like 10 to 15 hours before it was actually over. So, and again, I know that is just like, it feels like one criticism. It's too long, but it just kind of seeps into everything else about the game.
Yeah, so like the progression of this game is weird. So at the very beginning, like Mario and Luigi kind of first kind of get isekai'd into this other world. Mm-hmm. So Mario goes after Luigi after he's vaporized. You're like, oh, Luigi's dead, and then like the beginning's really strange because like you first start off as Mario, you're wandering around, you get very basic battle tutorials, and then like you start eventually following like almost hallucinating, but I guess, but like you start seeing Luigi's like ghost phantom, and like you run around for like, you know, very very briefly until you basically find your home hub, which is like this ship, and that's where Luigi is. And you meet like this whole new cast of characters, like Connie and all these other sorts of characters there. And what your basic objective is like you're this. I forgot if the whole world is called Concordia or not, but you're essentially, you got transported to a world that's been broken up, and you're trying to link them all back together. And to link them back together, they're now like all islands. You have to go to each island, which have different themes and so forth, and go to like, find the lighthouse, go to the top of it, and then link back these lighthouses via like the plugs on top of them into like the main island. So like you just have like this main hub that can like connect to these lighthouses on like islands you come across. And that it's interesting at first, but then it gets old really fast.
Yeah, so there's some very obvious and, like I said, easily digestible like theming here. The world is called Concordia. You are creating the unit tree to connect the world together.
Yes.
And literally, like, the game delves into like themes of unity and friendship and working together and things like that, which is all fine and good for a game like this. It's a little bit heavy-handed. I mean, it's right in your face, but it's, the world is literally called Concordia. It's what it is. It's fine. I accept it. And then
there's this release around after Concord.
Dang. I mean, it's
literally the definition of Concord, meaning like working together. But, yes. There's also this whole theming of like literally the inhabitants of Concordia, their faces look like electrical sockets, and you literally have like these giant plugs that you're plugging into your unit tree to like plug things together. There's the enemy squad, which is known as the extension core. It's silly, you know, it's whatever.
What was the name of like the three like for like antagonists at first, like the first three?
Oh, I think it's X10 and Shun.
Yeah, that's right.
And Shun.
Yeah.
I guess I'll talk about the part of the game that I actually was highest on, and I felt it was actually something I kind of want to see maybe dive into more if there's ever a chance for this game to be followed up on. It's the battle plug system. So the battle plug system, it's, if you've played other Mario and Luigi games or like Paper Mario games, you have the badges, which badges are kind of like your equipment in a Mario game, where they just offer some new ability or new property to your characters that you kind of set, and it changes some you know, parameter of your battle aptitude, yeah. right?
Get to have a lot of fun with a bunch of different options until you get the mushroom badge. And then it's like, well, why would I use anything else? Just buy a bunch of mushrooms.
Yeah. So battle plugs are kind of like badges, but they're more dynamic and they're more like a resource than an equipment. So battle plugs, very briefly, how they work is that you get a plug and you have like sockets that you can plug them into in your menu, basically. You start out with one, you eventually grow to five, so you can have five sockets to plug into. And there's a battle plug.
Minor corrections, you start out with two.
Oh, you start out with two? Okay. Start out with two and you end up with five. And basically, like one battle plug, for instance, one of the first ones you get is, I forget what it's called exactly, but it's like Iron Ball, where you jump on an enemy, and as long as you perform the timing properly, all Mario RPGs have the timing element to them, you will do your attack, and then like an Iron Ball will fall on the enemy, and you do like follow-up damage. So it's just like a slight improvement to your damage. There's another battle plug that allows it basically adds splash damage to your attacks. So it's like, okay, you do a jump on an enemy, as if you have that battle plug equipped, and you hit the timing, it'll splash to the enemies surrounding them. And then there's these combinations that can occur based on your battle plugs that are connected at the same time. And the obvious combination, which is one of the very first ones you get, is if you have both the splash damage and the Iron Ball battle plugs connected together, if you do a normal attack on one enemy, it'll splash out to all the enemies nearby and drop Iron Balls on all of them. So that's kind of an obvious, like, okay, by plugging in these two battle plugs, your regular jump attack now hits more than one enemy and does follow-up damage. So you're improving your output. As you go further and further into the game, you get more and more battle plugs with a bunch of different types of options that they add to the combat. For example, there's battle plugs that make it so your dodges that you do when the enemy's attacking are much easier to perform, or your counters. There's battle plugs that make it so that you are resistant to certain types of like status effects, like dizzy and whatnot in the game. There's plugs that make it so you take less damage. There's plugs that make it so that your bros attacks, which are your combination attacks, do more damage, but they cost more to run. There's quite a few to choose from.
And but how are they more like consumables instead of equipment?
Right. As you get further into the game, you'll get more and more battle plugs. The thing is they have charges. And so like that Iron Ball plug that I mentioned, it'll basically take place 10 times. I think it's 10 or maybe it's 15. And once that exhausts and when it gets down to zero, then it has to recharge. And it takes several turns to recharge, like, I don't know, 10 turns.
It's like 30 turns.
Really?
I've checked. Yeah, it's way more than.
Okay. But this does carry over across battles. And so how that ends up working, and I actually kind of like this, is that like you can't just set a battle plug and forget it like you would with a badge. You kind of set some to use in the meantime in your battles, and then once those are recharging, you can switch them out for other battle plugs with other components. And you're kind of constantly doing this sort of interchanging of plugs, and you can do this both in battle and out of battle. And like later on in the game, especially against some of like the end game or challenge bosses, you know, this actually becomes pretty important to know like which battle plugs to have, you know, like which one should you go into battle with, which one should you switch to mid-battle when the boss gets into a second phase or whatever. And like, I'm like, hey, this is actually like interesting to me, and it's actually requiring me to have some thought and like coordinate what I'm doing here in battle. And I actually wish the game went a little bit more deeper into this system. I do have a few qualms for this battle plug system, though. One, you cannot recharge battle plugs until they hit zero, which is a little bit annoying when you have like a battle plug that has like one or two charges left, and it's kind of like, I'm gonna have to equip this, kind of use it up, then wait 30 turns, and then it'll be recharged up to like 15-20 uses or whatever.
Yeah, let me paint an illustration.
Well, imagine if you could only charge your phone when it hit 0%. That'd be silly.
Yeah. It's a little, like, I kind of wish there's, you know, the obvious improvement would be, like, why not be able to, like, charge it before it runs out to zero? So, for example, like, the Iron Ball thing that lasts for, you know, 10 uses, right? You use it up, like, 8 times, it goes down to 2. You can't swap it out, and then it'll recharge again, like, you know, for however many turns. It has to actually reach zero before that, and then you swap it out, and then that's when it starts recharging. There's no mid swap. You can't like it has to go totally down to zero. It's kind of a weird thing because for me that's way more interesting tactically than having to exhaust them completely than waiting for the recharge. And some of these are like asynchronous, like that splash damage and AoE, or that splash damage and the iron ball. Like the splash damage is like 7 uses and the iron ball is 10, and then the recharge for them sometimes might not even like align. Like it might take like 20-25 turns to re-up the splash and then 30 turns for the iron ball. So it's kind of like asynchronous on both ends, where they'll both be exhausted at different times, and then they'll both be refilled at different times. So it's not like something that you can just like completely like just pair up and not think about it. It's just like, oh, they're all, you just have to remember. It's like, oh, okay, now they're both up because the 30 turns are up, so I can get them both that back and pair them together again.
I kind of wish they would just charge when they're in their background, when you're basically not connected.
I was gonna say, I like the idea of them being asynchronous, but with the caveat that if you could charge them whenever, the fact that you can't makes that really sound really kind of aggravating.
Yeah, there were definitely times when like I unhooked one of my plugs for something else, and then like, oh, I have this literally one charge plug sitting in my inventory, and it's just gonna sit at one charge forever because it'll never recharge. So I basically have to like, okay, let me put it into my battle, use it once, and then take it off again. So,
well, I was imagining that you're coming up on a boss fight or something, and you really want a plug up. So it's like, all right, I guess I gotta equip this and just like fight some random mooks for a bit, use it up, and then unequip it because they reach zero, and then fight more random mooks to charge it up, and then go into the boss fight. Is that a made up scenario? Like
you could do that, but I'm the type of person, I just go with the flow. Like, all right, what plugs do I have charged and ready for this boss fight? And I'll just use what I got and then switch them out when I can. If you wanted to be like min max, like, oh, I gotta charge up all my plugs before the boss fight, so I have ability access to all of them. You can do that.
Either way is fine, yeah. It's more of what are you willing to tolerate? Are you willing to tolerate like more tedious, you know, smaller battles, waiting for that big, you know, payoff at the boss, or just like, you know, just coast along and like kind of go with the flow of like, just exhaust some of the random battles to make them faster, and then I'll just work with what I have when I get to the boss. You know, both are valid, you know, approaches to it. But you could almost see the vision of like, this could be better. This could be way better. You know, whatever case scenario you're doing, you're just like, it could be better.
Well, that was my favorite part of the game, honestly, was the battle plugs.
Yeah. I think the other part I really liked on top of that was the Luigi logic during boss battle.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Luigi logic is kind of silly. It's kind of a callback to Dream Team when Luigi was like, you go into his dreams and he could kind of do whatever he wanted. Obviously, he's not a dream in this case, but basically, Luigi just has... you're fighting a boss. Like, for example, there's a boss that is like a robot thing. Like, he's like a trash can robot, basically. And you're fighting this boss, and then partway through the battle, as you're working him down, Luigi will basically have an epiphany, and he's like, wait a minute, I know what we can do. Leave it to me is what he says, and you do like this like quick time event. It's like a bros attack where you have certain buttons you need to press, but it's like unique to that battle. And if you do it properly, you can basically turn the tide a little bit, where the boss will be weakened for a moment or maybe take a hefty chunk of damage or whatnot. And this trash compactor boss that I mentioned, and literally what Luigi does is he puts the robot on like a conveyor belt that he has, that he learns how to control the conveyor belt, and you like drop like, I think it's crates on him. And so you press you basically move the conveyor belt and drop crates on the boss. It feels kind of like a quick time event in a way, but it's kind of, these don't last too long. So I'm kind of glad that they're not like too intrusive. And they are definitely valuable if you use them. It's just kind of a fun, admittedly gimmicky way to kind of make every boss feel a little bit unique, to have a little bit of like this event that can take place thanks to Luigi. And there's a handful of them. So
yeah.
There's also this Luigi logic can also take place in the field too, but it's more just like scripted events in terms of, oh, Luigi at this point in the game learns how to do this with your hammers or whatnot. So I did not mention this in my review, but this is definitely something I noticed and kind of just, I don't like it, but it's not that big a deal for me. You do not control Luigi with the B button.
Yeah.
So I saw this, yeah. And I was like, I saw people like, why would they change how you control Luigi? And it's been long enough since I played the other ones, I couldn't quite remember. So I'm interested to hear you detail this out. Like,
okay, so like in Superstar Saga, you are running across the field anywhere in the map, and obviously this is a Game Boy game. You press A, and Mario jumps. You press B, and Luigi jumps. So if you wanted to like jump a gap, you would have to do this like slightly timed A and then B to have Mario and then Luigi jump over a gap, right? And then in battle, all of Mario's abilities you would basically control with the A button, and all of Luigi's abilities you control with the B button. They were kind of like, they were kind of dedicated to their buttons, right? In this game,
yeah, I mean, and it was such a dedicated feature of the series that in Superstar Saga it has a whole like mini game to basically teach you, hey, you need to buff your jumps.
Yeah. In this game, Luigi works differently. Where Luigi functions differently, he operates differently in this game.
Podcast title right there.
Yeah, Luigi operates differently. So in this game, you control Mario only, and then like Luigi,
Mario has assumed direct control.
So in the other games, I believe, if I remember correctly, I don't know if it's all of them, but you can kind of switch and have Luigi in the front or Mario in the front. I don't quite remember, but you could control both of them. In this game, you only control Mario, and Luigi sort of like tails alongside behind you, like an AI party member, if you will. And then like when you jump a gap, Luigi will follow behind you, and hopefully the AI is smart enough to have him jump the gap behind you on his own. And there are times, and sometimes they fail, and it's like, come on, Luigi, get back up here and jump that gap, because you don't have control over him. He just tries to do it himself. And this also goes into battle, and this is like the smallest thing, but if you're a longtime, I guess, player of this series, it takes a bit of getting used to.
It fucked with me a lot.
You're playing in battle, you're playing as Mario, you're like, all right, I'm going to scroll along your battle options and press A to select which one I want. Now it's Luigi. Everyone knows when you are controlling Luigi, you scroll along your options and press B or the other button to select the one you want. But nope. In this game, you press A. It's the same button
for Mario and Luigi. A, but the QuickTime event, like bonus damage, it's still A and B. So you just have to remember, like if you're Luigi, you press A to confirm a selection. But when it's time to do the attack animation, it still follows A is Mario and B is Luigi. So you kind of have to switch your kind of thinking on the fly. During that, I'd adapt to it, which is
it's one of those things where it's like, is this a deal breaker? No, but also like, why do we do this?
it was right there. Come on.
And they're actually this is a minor thing, but I actually did see people like, admittedly, understandably, throw umbrage at this. There are these puzzles in the game where you have to step on numbers in a certain order. So imagine like a floor of numbers, like there's just kind of randomly scattered around. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then like some of the numbers are red and some of them are green. So if it's a red 1, you have to have Mario stand on it. But if it's a green 2, you have to have Luigi stand on it, and you have to do it in order. And the way the puzzle of the game works is like you have to step on the numbers in order, but Luigi is dumb, sorry Luigi, and he will like not wait for you. Like if you click on the red 1 and Luigi steps on the green 2, if you're not fast enough to make it to the red 3, Luigi's gonna step on the green 4 ahead of you. Yeah. And then like fail the puzzle, and it's just like
you'll have to race Luigi to like the proper thing and then like and pre-move before he does, because sometimes like you won't be able to make it if like you start moving when he gets there. You have to like already pre-move to the next number preemptively.
Now, there's only like maybe four of these puzzles in the game, or five or something like that, but it's still like it's basically working off the fact that Luigi is an AI and you kind of have to work with that, but it just doesn't really make sense. Like, why are you not waiting for me, Luigi? You know I have to step on the green, on the red 3 first before you can step on the green 4, but nope, he doesn't wait.
He doesn't use Luigi logic for those.
No.
Times.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so probably the last thing we haven't really gotten to. First of all, I should say, like, I think this game is okay. I don't think it's great. I think it's middle of the road. I think it would be a lot better if it was shorter and also if it performed better. But I think this game is okay. The game itself is this, the world itself is Concordia, and that's like this island nation. So you're on like this giant ocean, right? And you're on your main hub island, which Josh mentioned earlier, which is called Shipshape Island. And as Josh mentioned earlier, basically the structure of the game is you're going to these individual islands and you perform like a little mini story there. There's like a mystery on one, there's, you know, there's like a maze on another, and they kind of have different flavors to how these little mini scenarios work. But you complete the scenario, sometimes fight a boss, and then you connect the island. And by the end of the game, you have like 15 islands that are connected to your hub ship. But how the game works structurally, especially early on, is you're on your ship-shaped island, and you're like, okay, we need to make our way to the next island that's a couple zones over. But it's going to take you a considerable amount of time to get there, like a good 5 minutes, maybe a few minutes anyway, to get from where we are to where you're going. There's like, it takes time to get there, like literally real time. And now you don't. No, let me finish. Sorry. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry.
But it's just like, so you could just wait a couple minutes. It's probably like 3 or 4, maybe probably not quite 5 minutes. You have to wait a couple minutes to get there. And the game even kind of says, like, while you're waiting, you can go back to one of the islands you've already explored and, like, grind a bit. Get some levels, get some money while you wait. And this kind of really rubbed me the wrong way. Like, quite literally, find a way to waste time as you wait to get to your destination. And I was like, this is a really strange mechanic that you kind of have to, like, baked in grinding time as you travel. But relatively early on in the game, you do get a mechanism to go much, much, much faster on the ocean. So it no longer takes minutes to travel anywhere. We're talking just maybe 1 minute or so. So you don't really have to worry about this. But it was just a really weirdly introduced and like a very weird concept in general that I'm honestly kind of just wondering like why they even entertain this idea at all. It's very strange. What were you going to say, yeah. Josh?
Yeah, just to paint an illustration for people who don't know what's going on. Like, because it's like we're obviously on a ship. This whole game takes place like in the ocean, like you're sailing the seas and whatnot. So on this overhead view map, you see like currents. Usually they're like almost like rectangular shaped currents. And obviously, since you're following the current, you can't like go. You have no control over which way of the current you go. You kind of just follow it. So it'll be like one like rectangle shape. Then there's like an arrow, and then you choose that arrow to get onto the next current, and then that current might have like islands all across it that you can view through like a telescope on like your island, and then you know through that viewfinder you select that island and you like cannon off to it. So, but it takes time to get into view of that island, like Adam was saying. So early on, you can switch like which current you're on, and then your ship will go. Switch like from one rectangle to the other, and then once it switches over, you have to wait more time because you're following the current until these islands come into view before you can like cannon off to them. And so, like as Adam was saying, like it tells you like in a tutorial pop up, hey, go backtrack to like other islands that you went to as you're waiting in real time for these islands to come into view because like there's like you know as collectibles that you can get there, you can use it to grind, and these collectibles you can use eventually to like get more like. Plugs once that mechanic is unlocked hours on end. And, you know, so it's just like a weird, like, I'm with you, Adam. Like, it's like just a really, really weird, like, real time, like, backtracking time waster because before you get that, like, upgrade to sail faster, you're just kind of like twiddling your thumbs if you're not doing anything, right? You're just like, you're kind of just like, okay, I guess I'm just gonna either wait here or go back and do, like, an island, but you want to make sure that you want to get back in time to your home island to that telescope, because you know, the game won't wait for you if islands come into view.
Yeah, you could sail right past it.
Yeah, you can sail right past them. So you have to make sure you leave that island and then go back in time to that to that viewfinder before that island, you know, you sail past it.
I could foresee an RPG where I would be totally okay with that, but no way in hell would a Mario RPG be the place for that sort of mechanic for me.
It's so weird. So you have to mentally think, okay, I got to run back and make sure I'm there in time to cannon off to the island. And then a lot of this is mitigated eventually, you know, maybe 5 to 6 hours on in. To get this story upgrade to at least, you know, you can toggle to go faster and make that so once you get this
what the upgrade literally is, it's literally like a pair of toads saying, hey, we got these giant leaves and we could paddle and we'll go faster. Okay.
Yeah, so it becomes more viable now to just stare at your map screen and then turn it on and then just stare at the map for at least 1 or 2 minutes before you get into view. So instead of just waiting in real time normally to go backtrack and do other things. And so that just becomes your at least for me, my main way of going to the next part is I no longer just backtrack unless I wanted the consumables. Yeah. I just stared at the map screen and then to watch it go faster.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where this upgrade that you get, which again you get pretty early, it kind of negates this whole topic that we're talking about here, more or less. But it's still just why? Why do you do it this way?
I wouldn't say it's as big of a deal in that game, but it kind of reminds me how, one of my complaints with Echoes of Wisdom is that you have the whole, ecosystem, but then very, very early on the game gives you this, hey, here's this meter you can use to turn basically into Link and just use regular Legend of Zelda combat. And the majority of the game, it's like, well, I want to be using that when I can because it is a pain in the ass to try and fight enemies using the Echo. So it's it kind of reminds me of that, where it's it almost feels like they weren't confident in the systems they had. So they're here, we'll just give you an ability to kind of bypass it.
Yeah. So this is very, very strange. Adam already briefly brought it up, but I really wonder if the Switch's successor will have a patch for this game to make it run better on that system, or the 30 FPS cap, fine, whatever, you know, it's not great, but I wish it was at least a smooth 30 FPS. But no, this game struggles to run on a Switch. Many times you'll have stuttering in the game, and that doesn't feel great when it's a lot of the game is timing based.
Right.
So just okay. so what are we doing here, Nintendo?
I guess we didn't cover it in a headline specifically, but they did go on social media and say, yep, the successor will be backwards compatible. Nintendo Switch Online will carry over. A lot of those things that we kind of be like, it better, but we didn't know for sure.
There's no.
So that's good. I guess. No confirmation that the backwards compatible will include performance improvements, but
hopefully. I mean, it should be the same base architecture. It should, if nothing else, perform a little bit better. It should smooth things out because it's not going to be emulating. It's going to be running it on basically. So I'd imagine for stuff like Echoes of Wisdom, which has the terrible double buffered V-Sync, which is why that game runs terribly, because it's if you're not going to maintain 60 and you're using double buffered V-Sync, just cap it at 30. That's literally that game's problem. If they just capped it at 30, I would literally prefer that.
Yeah.
Because then it would be a smooth 30 at least. So.
But, but I mean, I don't know. The game's strange. It's definitely not my favorite Mario and Luigi game. It's okay. Like you said, Adam. Also, for some people who like the tracks in Mario and Luigi, this game has its fair share of great music, but obviously Shimomura isn't involved with Brothership. Who was the composer?
I think the composer is Hideki Sakamoto, not to be confused with Hitoshi Sakamoto. if this composer Hideki did some like Pokemon Mystery Dungeon music, as well as some like Super Smash Brothers music, I think. So
yeah, that's a good fit. Like, yeah.
Can you imagine if you got Hitoshi Sakamoto?
That'd be very strange. That'd be a weird mix.
A lot of grand tracks in the game all of a sudden. Epic sailing adventure.
The music where you fight the extension core, that boss fight music, is probably my favorite in the game. It's kind of this jazzy, very appropriate Mario & Luigi style battle energy music. But overall, I think the soundtrack is just, it's okay. It's good enough. Like it wasn't really a highlight, but it didn't detract for me at all. So it's good.
I don't want them to stop making Mario and Luigi games. I hope, like, just because, they, like, obviously this didn't get the greatest reviews, glowing reviews, but I want them to continue making new Mario and Luigi games, and seeing like a new one for the first time, like a brand new one, after how many years, like, it's cool. Just like, hopefully they kind of learned the lessons of like the failings of this one and try it again.
I just wonder how long this has actually been done, because I remember, like, apparently the required system software for the game is like 2 years old. So it's like Nintendo. Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, they're the only company in the industry that will just finish games and be like, we'll sit on it for a bit.
Like, what other... Engage was like that, right? Engage was rumored, at least, to be done for a year plus before it got released, Fire Emblem.
Yeah, and based off the internal data for Engage, we know that Fire Emblem remake, probably Genealogy remake, is in development, because Engage is like one number off what it should be based off of when it released.
Adam, how's the difficulty of Brothership? The reason why I ask is because from the two games that I have played, especially Bowser's Inside Story, it starts out very easy, which is fine for a game of this size. But then it kind of surprises you at the end, where it's like, well, this is actually like ratcheting up more than I expected it to.
I remember Cacoletta in Super Star Saga being actually a little bit of a pain. But that's like the final boss.
I played that when I was a kid, and I was very angry because, especially phase two, it's like, here's like three really kind of relatively challenging attacks to dodge. You have one HP. If both Mario and Luigi gets hit by one of those, start over.
Yeah. I feel like, okay, so most of the game, as you start off, is relatively easy. I don't think there are difficulty modes. I think it's just one difficulty. Maybe about halfway through the game, there are side quests in this game, which is also, I didn't talk about these, but like literally there'll be like an NPC on your ship, which there's a lot of NPCs in this game. Like, it's actually sort of surprising to me. Like, oh, there's a lot of like kind of characters that like have names and stuff. But anyways, they'll just have like a, can you go here and do this thing? Kind of fetchy type side quests. There are a few that have like challenge battles. And like, for example, one of the challenge battle side quests that you can get in the back half of the game, there's these shark enemies, like sand sharks, where their gimmick is basically they one-hit KO you, more or less. So you can beat them if you can dodge them, which in Mario games, if you know how to counter and dodge, you can. But it's basically testing you that way. Like, can you dodge these enemies long enough to beat them? Because if they hit you once, you're dead. And then there's a couple of challenge battles that, like, for example, there's another one where there's enemies that basically have, like, an ability to heal themselves to full, like, after any turn. So, like, they have too much health to beat in one turn, but they can heal themselves to full whenever they want. So how do you beat them? Well, how I beat them was I equipped a plug that basically caused dizzy and basically caused them all to be dizzy so they couldn't do anything, and then I beat them. So there's a couple of challenges like that where it kind of bends the battle system in a way where it's like, do you know how to manipulate the mechanics that are here to win? And those are cool, you know? And then there are a few bosses that are like refights, like bosses that you fight in the story, but you can fight them again, but they're harder. And they have more abilities the second time you face them. And if you take them on as soon as they're available, they're actually going to be a bit over-leveled compared to you. So that adds to the challenge. So I guess my short answer to your question is there are definitely moments of challenge, and then even if they're optional, And then by the end of the game, some of the bosses are moderately challenging. But have you seen that ProZD vid where if you do all the side quests and you take all the final boss, you just can flick them when they're dead? Yeah, it sort of felt like that for me. Like, oh, I'm way over leveled for this. So, yeah. That's my answer.
No, that seems like kind of in line with where the series has been before. So at least it didn't get overtuned in that way, in addition to the runtime kind of caveats in terms of things taking too long. So I don't know. This is the sort of game that definitely feels like I could, like, I kind of realized that the release schedule for this fall has been too quick to stay up on everything. So this one I'm kind of earmarking for like an early next year, getting around to it. Because yeah, it didn't review that great, but at least it's like Josh said, I'm happy to see that the series has continued. It looks like Acquire has kind of picked up the mantle in a pretty good spot in terms of like having the same characterization, translating the art style into something that's more modern, but still keeps the feeling of the previous one.
There was actually this one small thing that I didn't notice, like a continuity thing that I guess some people picked up on. I guess in the earlier Mario and Luigi games, Bowser, he's in this game, he never calls Luigi by his name. That was just like his thing. He didn't know who Luigi was. And I guess somewhere in Dream Team, he finally learns who Luigi is and starts calling him Luigi. And I saw someone glad that in this game, Bowser refers to Luigi as Luigi, as like continuity. Oh. Like, hey, they remembered.
That's pretty good. Didn't even notice, yeah.
So, yeah.
And thank you, Adam, for writing up a review on Mario and Luigi Brothership. We have that up and written on the site, rpgsite.net, if you want to see Adam's written thoughts. And the other game that released this week is one that we brought up a few times. We just brought it up last week, saying that it was also coming to Game Pass in addition to its full release, and that is Metal Slug Tactics. Of course, this is a game that was announced a few years back. It was originally supposed to release a few years ago, kind of went dormant for a while, resurfaced in the summer, and said it was going to release this fall, and then finally picked a release window in the first week of November. So, Josh, you said that you at least were able to put a little bit of time into this.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've got history with Metal Slug series, because, of course, this is not like a traditional Metal Slug game. It's a tactics game, and not even like a traditional tactics game. It's a roguelike. So try to dilute that all down for us, how this game plays for fans of the series or people who aren't familiar with the series and all that.
Yeah, this has been kind of a little bit in development hell for a while. This comes from developer Lakeir Studio and publisher.mu. And, you know, when we first heard about this game several years ago, it was supposed to come out in 2022 until it got indefinitely delayed tweet and so forth until it resurfaced again this year. I'm not like a huge, like diehard Metal Slug fan. Like, I've definitely played a good chunk of them.
One credit, one and two. Didn't one credit nice. Cleared the third one, though. The third
one's hard. They're all fucking hard games to me. So I didn't one credit any of them. But I did beat,
I believe James also one credit them. Did you, James?
At one point, I was able to one credit clear Metal Slug 3, which is basically the only one that matters.
Damn. He's flexing that one. I'm only flexing one and two.
But the franchise has been kind of like in a weird sort of state, I guess. Like the most recent ones that I know of are like were sort of mobile games. One came to Steam before this that was originally a mobile game, and now it's like something that you can pay for, I believe. And then you don't have to deal with any of the microtransactions. But either way, people don't want like, you know, a free to play model style mobile game games. So Metal Slug Tactics is also not like a traditional Metal Slug game. Obviously, it's not a side scroller action game, or what they call belt action sometimes these days. It's more of a strategy RPG, but I think the thing that has caught a lot of people off guard is that it's a strategy RPG, but also has like a roguelike progression to it. It's not like a whole grand adventure of like, you know, you have a starting area and then like, and then you go to the end of the game and it's all good. It's like it's a run-based game where,
not to be ignorant, it's like I didn't even hear it was a roguelike until like a week ago, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't really do a great job like communicating that Especially the announcement of the game, you know, they never even brought that up. It was only until like somewhat recently they started putting a focus on that, but even then. So at the start of the game, you have like the core three, Marco, Eri, and Fio as your playable characters. And you have like kind of this home area where you can like kind of choose who you want to bring out and then tweak their loadouts and so forth. And I'll go into that a little bit later. But the core thing at the moment is like you have this home base, you pick the three characters you want to use, and then you set forth. And then when you set forth, you have it's like kind of an interesting progression where you have these three regions. You can unlock the like this first region, and then the other two you can unlock later at your first playthrough. And after you unlock them, it's permanently unlocked. So you have like these two.
I was going to ask you: is there no Toma? Toma's like the second player characters. They're not in this.
There's other playable characters that I'll get into, but there's other playable characters that you unlock. There's Tarma, and then Ralph, Clark, Leona, Trevor, and Nadia. That's all the other characters you can unlock. So it's kind of it's the Ikari Warriors, and then some of the other
Metal Slug 4.
Yeah, Metal Slug 4 characters. Yeah. So. Yeah, but the base starting roster is Marco, Eri, and Fio, and then the other characters you unlock, you can unlock later through like special conditions, like beating the game after completing three regions, or completing the game after completing two regions, and so forth. So stuff like that, or like beating the game with this character may unlock another character. But then these three regions that you can eventually choose from once you unlock all of them, there's like different like nodes in them that have like different maps. And each node in these regions gives you something. So like completing like one node, like this map might give you like extra money and it'll refill your secondary weapons, while another node might give you extra reinforcements, which is kind of like your revive charges. A skill selection after you complete that map. It's sort of like Into the Breach, if you guys have played that, where you can there's like tangible like rewards per map for battle that you can complete that you can like preview beforehand. So like even before a battle starts, you're already making strategic decisions on like, okay, I want to tackle this battle first on this map because I need to refill the ammo of my secondary weapons because those don't refill per battle. Or it could be like, I'm running low on revival charges. I want to tackle this map to at least get like one reinforcement revival charge back because I've been dying a lot. Or it could be simply as, I need extra money. So, like, when I complete this map and get access to the shop, I'll have extra money to, like, purchase upgrades for my weapons and my character, and so forth. And then, so after you complete, like, I think it's, like, three to four battles in a map, you won't be able to complete every node on the region that you select. So, like, you pick, like, three to four battles that you want to take up before the boss appears in that region. And then once the boss appears, you are forced to fight that boss battle. You cannot like grind additional nodes in that region once the boss appears. You have to fight it head on. And then these bosses are like very recognizable from Metal Slug history, like the big ass like warship it was called, as like one of the region's bosses. After you beat that boss, you get access to like a shop before you choose whether you want to go to another region or the final region for a run. So like these three regions that before the final region is like, it's like the jungle, the desert, and like I think it's like the ruins or something. But they all have different enemies. But after you complete one region, you can forego doing any other region. It's going straight to like to the city region where you start like making your way to like the final boss in a run. So it's kind of up to you how much you want to like build up your characters and grind before you tackle on like the final region in a run. And you some characters and unlocks are dependent on this. So, like, for example, like one of the characters might be like, complete a run by only completing two regions. So that means, you know, you can only do one region and then do like the final region to unlock that character. One of the characters might unlocks might be like, complete all three regions and then the final region, the city region. So that means like complete all four regions to unlock this character and so forth. So there's obviously like incentives to do the runs like differently, whether you're super geared up or like whether you're like on a minimalist run because you're working towards like a certain unlock in the game. So but even when you travel to like another region before the final region, for example, it's still that same flow and cadence where you're going to a region, you see these nodes in the region which are different battles, and you start thinking about like, you know, what kind of benefits you want, like a consumable that you can choose from and earn in this battle, or do you want like a ammo refill, etc. So until like the boss appears again and so forth, and you have that decision. And then obvious, but all roads lead to that final city region into like the same final boss in a run. So it's not like, but whether you achieve that or not, you know, obviously within that roguelike nature is completely up to like your decision and your ability to kind of plan ahead and execute.
It's not quite the same, but it sounds a little bit similar to when Adam played Star Renegades a few years ago, about following different nodes on a, like plotting out a route on a map where the destination was always kind of like the end of that chapter, but how you get there would be the roguelike element in terms of like what buffs you get, how do you want to build, with the added caveat of the kind of like the unlock criteria that you've talked about. What I'm thinking right here is that I don't have a lot of experience with roguelikes. Hell, I haven't even played like Hades. But like everything you're describing sounds perfectly fine. The one question for me is like, why Metal Slug as an IP? Like, I don't know. Like, to me, it just seems kind of like random. Like, do Metal Slug players?
I think, you know, if I'm thinking like how they wanted to like translate like the spirit of Metal Slug into a strategy RPG in a format like this, it's like when you think about like the base Metal Slug series, it's all about repetition, right? All about learning enemy patterns, like how to perform better in a run, like eventually being able to 1cc a run. You're going through these stages very, very, like in a very repeated fashion to learn how to play the stage properly and try to not to minimize damage. So you're kind of learning like what's the best play style for you versus the enemy patterns, where they're going to appear from, what sort of waves you're dealing with. That's all very systematic, and there's no randomness in that. It's all about you learning that certain pattern, and so that's what I'm thinking, at least with this robot.
Yeah, structure. Okay, I can see that. It does kind of rhyme that way.
Mm-hmm. So when you get into like these stages themselves, they're not all that big. You know, some stages might just be like just like this one arena. Some other stage objectives might be like destroy this enemy vehicle before it reaches a destination. And then another objective might be like escort this NPC to like their destination without them dying, so forth. But they're not all that long. They might take like maybe, depending on how long you do your turns, maybe like 5-10 minutes max per battle. Obviously, it all depends on how long you're planning out your moves. But Metal Slug has an interesting kind of cadence to it, where it's trying to preserve the spirit of Metal Slug, like, and a lot of that spirit is run and gunning. So you're incentivized to move your characters, your squad of three, to move as much as possible, because the farther they move, the more they'll gain this dodge stat. And this dodge stat is a little bit deceptive when you're thinking about like, oh, so they just like completely evade shots coming to them. It's more of a damage reduction in this game. Think of it as like a defense almost. Where, let's say you move a certain amount of tiles out and you gain 3 dodge from it. So that means the next incoming attack coming to you will be deducted by 3. So let's say a shot, an enemy shoots at you and it's supposed to do 6 damage normally. But since you have 3 dodge on you, it'll reduce that number to 3. And then there's also like, additional modifiers as well. Let's say you move out and then you move like behind cover as well, and that cover gives like two cover. So like if you get three dodge plus two cover, that's a total of five. So that's that shot that does six damage, that'll be one instead. So so there's a certain amount of incentive to move as much as possible and not stay still, because staying still means you're foregoing any amount of you're not able to accumulate dodge at all if you just stay in place. But sometimes it's the right move depending on like what your formation is. Not necessarily to say that like always moving is the right decision, but that's the incentive to keep on moving in this
game. On paper, that sounds like a decent risk reward sort of balancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And it's also interesting. So like all your characters have a primary and a secondary weapon, and each of them have usually different ranges. But if a character is able to like line up a shot and it's like and that enemy is also within the range of like other characters, they'll perform sync attacks. So like you fire off a shot with a character, and if that character is in range of like another character's weapons, they'll immediately activate on their own through a sync attack, and they'll attack again within that one shot. So like say like Eri fires her pistol, and that enemy is in the range of like Marco's primary pistol. So like she'll fire the shot, then Marco will automatically activate and fire off shots. Obviously, you get more attacks, dealing more damage within that single turn. So there is a certain positional element in this game, because you can activate multiple sync attacks. Like you can, like if both Eri and Marco fired off their sync attacks, and that enemy was also in the range of like Fio's attack, she'll also activate a sync attack immediately as well. So that's kind of the set of like, hey, move as much as possible, but also kind of be within range with each other, so you're able to like sync attack with each other whenever you need to, as well. And as you're moving and across the map and getting dodge, you also get this resource. I believe it's called momentum. And this resource allows you to activate skills, active skills for them. So for example, Fio might have eventually like you get a skill with her that allows you to like shield a party member and heal them as well. So in order to use that, she needs to accrue enough momentum to like activate that shield ability to do that as well. So that's kind of the basic flow of the game. There's also like just really neat stuff around it, like, you know, like some of the consumables might be like, hey, you can summon parachute in a metal slug into battles. So you have like this big ass tank that someone can get into maneuver that tank. It does a lot of damage, has a lot of defense, so just kind of it tips the tides massively in your favor, having that metal slug in battle. And there's also like crafty stuff that you can do with that, like kind of next level thing of like Marco has an ability to I guess summon this AI into the field, and you can kind of use that AI as a fourth party member almost, if you have like a vehicle on the field, and instead of like one of your active party members driving that vehicle, you use like Marco's AI to drive that instead. Even though you don't have direct control, you have like a rogue party member, like, you know, doing off the and doing their own thing as well. Just kind of like ability synergy in a sense. So as you complete runs, whether you fail or complete it, you'll get money from it. Obviously, the better you do, the more money that you get. You go back into your home base, and this is where you'll start unlocking better, or not better, but alternative options for your characters. Like, for example, there are loadouts per character, and let's say Ares, like, starting loadout is like explosive grenade launcher loadout. So it's kind of, it does a lot, it does great AoE damage, and it is more range focused, but it's kind of like unwieldy in certain party comps. because, you know, there can be friendly fire as well. So you can unlock a loadout for her for a certain amount of money, and that makes her more melee focused. She has like a baton or tanfa or some sorts, and it's really good at just getting extra bonus turns, because every time she kills someone with that on her turn, she might get like a bonus action, which allows her to like move and attack again, as long as she can like keeps on like, you know, eliminating targets with that melee build or loadout almost. So that completely changes up how you use Eri, because she's no longer like this explosive AoE like support. Now she's like out in the front taking out dudes at melee range. So you're sacrificing, you know, obviously a range tactic for a more up close strategy, but it allows her to move more through that. So you can unlock different loadouts, and that will change like a character's primary and secondary weapon. So obviously that has some big implications of like how, but they have like a different role in battle almost. You can unlock like different items that can like upgrades that can drop for them. So after like you level up in battle, there's like a certain selection of upgrades that they have. So you can unlock more selections for them as you use money from completed runs. You can unlock more upgrade selections for your like primary and secondary weapons. And not just like a whole bunch of other stuff on top of like unlocking different characters. So, you know, every character has like a whole load of like different things to unlock for them, whether it's different loadouts, different upgrades for their weapons, different ability selections that can show up in a run, which is, you know, a lot of different roguelites do this, whether it's like Dead Cells or Slay the Spire. It's basically unlocking different things that can appear in your run, and also unlocking different loadouts, which, you know, kind of turns them into a different role. So that character, how you play them is fundamentally changed. An example of how this comes together is like Tarma, for example. You can unlock a knife that attacks every adjacent grid square, and then, you know, it's like, okay, that's cool. But then eventually he can unlock a passive that gives you a free action each time you attack three targets or more. It's like, okay, that's kind of an interesting passive that, you know, if you position it right, he can kind of gets the engine running. And then eventually, like, you might be able to, like, get, like, an upgrade that mirrors his weapon. So he attacks twice, once forward, once backwards. And it's a complete just upgrade that lets him like attack in multiple ways, and if he hits, which allows more targets to potentially be targeted. And since you attack three targets, and if you attack three or more targets, he gets a free action, and you're more likely to do that because you've expanded his range by a lot through those upgrades. Just a very, very small example of like how you could kind of build characters to like kind of be killing machines almost. And that's not even factoring in like other party chemistry things that can like kind of bounce off like what he can do as well. Like, you know, he could like have other characters like be sync attack gods from range through that. So he's up at the front triggering sync attacks while getting bonus actions for free, while other characters around the edges are like taking them, piling in additional damage through their sync attack. So it's like stuff like that. I was like, it's really interesting what they're going for, and the strategies that you can form is really, 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 really cool. It's just at the current moment, a lot of people are experiencing a lot of like bugs. Unfortunately, like when I played this, I didn't like have too many issues with bugs, but some people have like disappearing enemies. Some people have finicky controls. I think the one thing I don't like is this game suffers from. Sometimes when you're trying to pick a tile on where to move, if there's an object in the foreground blocking that tile, the selecting that tile can get finicky, and there's no way to rotate the camera in this, so you're stuck with this isometric view and no way to kind of play with the camera to kind of get a different perspective on to select that tile. A lot of people who are playing on Steam Deck, because this would be a great Steam Deck game, but the font size, the default font size, there's no way to change the font size at the moment in this game. It's very, very, very small. There's like a lot of tooltips too. Like they do a good job with the tooltips and having expanding windows to give clarification of like every single like status effect or like any terminology in this game. But since those are represented to like collapsing like more and more windows on the screen, it's just a lot more small text on the screen that wouldn't be great on a Steam Deck screen. I think the developers already acknowledge that like they're gonna look into bigger font size options, so hopefully that they iron it out. But you know, it's a completely like it's a super interesting strategy RPG, but the roguelike element is very hit or miss for people. Like we discussed earlier, and they didn't market the roguelike progression of this game and the structure of this game all that well. So a lot of people are like, you know, this game seems cool, but they're not a fan of roguelike structures. So that could turn them off. Like some people thought that like, hey, you have like the starting party members, and along the way you like meet the Ikari warriors and they'll join your party, then you'll meet the other characters and they'll join your party, eventually taking out like a big bad, like, you know, final boss after like, you know, gaining all these levels and progressing through the game like linearly. Which is, you know, I get it too. That seems awesome as well.
Yeah, Adam put out the first press release for this game back when it was announced in 2021. And they talk about having it be highly replayable. That's the closest they get to talking what it is.
Mm. Yeah. And maybe at the time, in our chat that listeners can't see, I posted the very first press release for this game. I was curious, like, how did they announce it? And they call it an exciting adaptation of the iconic series, satisfying action through grid-based tactical warfare, coming to PC, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, it's literally in the third paragraph, where the second sentence of the third paragraph, where they're like, roguelike elements make missions highly replayable. It's like, that's
so it. So it was there, we just wasn't reading.
Well, it's buried.
Yeah, it's buried in there, and people aren't going to read press releases. They're going to, you know, go to the trailers, and usually most people, you know, if they're not saying that in the trailer, which I don't think they did, then people aren't going to know, you know? So, yeah. I guess they're just like flew out, like, it went above people's radars in terms of, like, how they message. So, it's not necessarily, like, the inherent fault of the game. It's just, like, it's just different expectations, right? Like, for me, I'm totally fine with the game being having a roguelike structure, you know? So, I'm used to that, but I can understand why people be so jazzed about it.
How many hours do you have in Slay the Spire?
Way too much. I mean, it's like between like Into the Breach and Slay the Spire. It's like probably triple digits for both of them easily. It's like they're both really, 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 really fun games.
And I also have one really dumb comment. You're talking about bringing in a fourth unit as an AI party member. I'm like, oh, Luigi.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Yeah, you have Luigi as a party member. Come on in, honorary Metal Slug. Character so, Luigi.
Yeah. So basically it sounds like, you know, the framework of the game, the mechanics that are in place are pretty well thought out and pretty engaging. It's just not maybe what people expected out of the game, which is not a bad or a good thing, just expectations.
Yeah, by the nature of it being a roguelike structure, like it'll get repetitive. Like you'll go through like the same stages. And you know what to expect. Higher difficulties will have like some newer enemies, but by and large, you know what to expect after you've completed like several runs of it. It's like, okay, here we go again to, you know, maybe tackle another thing. But you're not necessarily after you've like put like some time into it, after you've finished like maybe like, you know, 4 to 5 runs, you're just like, okay, I know what to expect. There's nothing new really waiting for me. Here we go again.
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to put some time into it and kind of tell us about it. So hopefully the bugs and the issues with the font and it seems like the sort of game that could just use another pass of polish and really kind of make it shine to what it could be.
Yeah.
Don't want these little artificial limitations with technical difficulties hold it back too much. And with that, we'll go into a few of the other articles that have gone up on the site in the last week. Obviously, we have the Mario and Luigi review up on the site from Adam. Mikhail did put up a, I guess, visual novel is the closest genre for this one, review up on the site, which we've kind of done from time to time. This is for a game that originally came out a couple years ago, but had like a director's cut release in the last month. And that is Slay the Princess, the Pristine Cut. So this is a game that is like a, it's a looping story where you, I've watched a playthrough of this online. And it's a looping story where you, a character comes across like an abandoned building, and there's like a princess that is caged in the basement, and you have to figure out like why are they caged, like what secret is she hiding. She's saying like, please release me, I won't hurt you. And then as you go through, you have branching options, the story like forks a bunch of different ways. I've seen like diagrams online for all the different ways the story can permute based on your choices. It loops, and as you go through and learn different things, you can kind of choose new routes. So Mikhail just went ahead and covered this game for us in his usual style, talking about Steam Deck, talking about Switch, and put a review up on the site. Did he score it? He did score it, and he scored it a 9, so he thought pretty highly of it. And I think if you go to Steam, this game has been received pretty well for those that like these sort of narrative games with really kind of unique, interesting art. So he kind of went out and did like a Branching Path style review for us up on the site at rpgsite.net. We also have a preview for a game that we talked about a few months ago. This is the MMO-like game called Brighter Shores, made from the same creative director as RuneScape, the original RuneScape. And Junior went ahead and played the early access, or had a preview access to Brighter Shores, and kind of touched upon his time with the early access of the game. Comparing it to RuneScape in a lot of ways, a lot of the comparisons are pretty genuine in terms of clearly have the same kind of fundamentals and design aspirations. More of a focus on abilities, less of a focus on straight up combat, things like that. I guess RuneScape at some point had a combat update to give it like traditional, like cooldown based, skill based combat system. To me, that just seems like that's not the RuneScape I remember. He went ahead and kind of gave us a pretty lengthy and detailed preview of Brighter Shores, talking about what the game does well and some of the things that it clearly hasn't focused on or could use a little bit of polish. So it was really cool for Junior to touch on that, because otherwise I don't think we would have anyone that would be able to report in on it. So we have that written up and up on the site as well. And the last one we have, I think James has mentioned this in previous episodes of the podcast. Recently released in Japan in September, we have the most recent entry in the Kiseki Trail series, Kai no Kiseki. And I think, Josh, you had talked about it because you had basically watched a whole playthrough with a buddy. And then James had basically spent the last couple of weeks playing through it. And basically, James put up an import review, unscored, so to speak, up on the site. So, James, I don't know. Obviously, we have Daybreak 2 coming out in English next February. So we don't want to skip that completely, but I don't know if you want to give your general impressions of Kai, at least in terms of a theming or feel or where the series is, and trying to your best extent avoid specific spoiler story concerns.
Surprisingly enough, it wasn't too hard to write about the game without talking about specific spoilers, because there's a lot that the game does that you can very clearly point to that doesn't have to do with specific story beats. First off, like I said in the, I'm just going to call it a review because it is a review, even though it's not scored. It's fascinating how it's taken 13 games, but we're finally at the point where we can point to, okay, this is where the story is heading. This is the finish line. Or at least we have a pretty damn good idea for it now. So I did greatly enjoy the game. I wrote as much in my review, but it's definitely not perfect. One of the main issues is that it really is the perfect 20th anniversary game, because it is everything that Trails has been, the good and the bad. And one of the bad things about it is definitely the pacing. And I know that Chow has played the game, so he can probably vouch for it, where it's like, especially if you're doing all the side content, which I I'm not going to sit here and say that if you go through Trails games and you just do the main story, that that's wrong. But it's very clear that Falcom at least assumes that when you're
expects you to do it.
Yeah, they expect you to basically do everything in their game. Like even as far back as like Cold Steel 2, where it's like, hey, here's a reference to a New Game Plus exclusive scene in Cold Steel 3. You did do this, right? We're just going to assume that you did or you're familiar with it. And it's like,
like, did you collect the black records in Cold Steel 2? It's like, what are you talking about? I don't know what the experience would be for a player that does not do any of the side content, and they would be like, what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah, and then there's like references in Kai to some post-game stuff in Kuro 2, which wasn't even in the game at launch. It was like a post-game patch, so, which I guess technically Reverie did the same thing, where there's like the daydreams, or it's like, here's some like VN segments that are set, that are setting up the Calvert arc. And those have been referenced multiple times in like the Calvert arc. So nothing new for the series, but it's a, I bring that up because there is so much side content in this game. And I guess to put in perspective, without spoiling anything specifically, there is a specific act in Daybreak 2 that's kind of infamous from people that have played it for how long it goes and it being a bit of a drag. And I ended up not disliking it as much as I feel like most people. It's definitely not good, but I feel like it's whatever. But the way the act is split up is there's like six chunks to it. Like six routes, if you were. And in Daybreak 2, each of those chunks has one or two side quests. Act 2 and 3 in Kai are also kind of similarly structured, where there's a bunch of routes. Like there, like between Act 2 and 3, there's like six van routes and then six of other characters' routes. With the exception of the of one of those, every single one of those routes is going to have at least three side quests, sometimes four or five. Not to mention all the connect events, which, thank God, this game lets you view connect events that you didn't originally choose. I can't believe it's taken them this long to let you do that, because there's some, like, there's some connect events that, quite frankly, should have been main story.
Yeah, but it's also like a blessing and a curse in that respect, where it's like, it was like, connect events were like kind of endearing, but like the first Daybreak came around, because it was like a fairly contained cast, but since there's like kind of a lot of characters that it's like gone to now in Kai,
yeah,
it's just like a shitload of like, oh man, this character has like four connect events that like I have to go view now. This character, there's still like four or five more characters at connect events that I still have to view.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like it's a blessing and a curse. Like, it's cool that you can do that. It's also just, it's a lot. It's a fucking lot.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, it's not even the content itself that's a problem. It's just that there is so much of it. And to an extent, I understand it. There's a lot of characters, and I wouldn't say, with some very minor exceptions, that any of the side content in this game feels forced. Even Grim Garden would be maybe the one, but I feel like the payoff for that at least is substantial enough that it's like whatever in the end. But it's just, there's just so much of it. There's just so much of it. And that's really, it just impacts the pacing. That's the one thing. The other thing I said is that because of the way the game structure works, is that Van's group, most of this, you basically get drip fed information in Van's group, Van's routes. Whereas the other two routes, you get a lot more like big plot reveals. And I get the point is that those other two characters are working behind the scene. Well, other two groups are kind of working behind the scenes, so they're getting all that information. And you're basically using that to the game. I guess one of the most interesting things about Kai is that from the beginning, even though you don't know for sure what's going to happen, though, if you know Japanese, the lyrics to the opening theme kind of gives you an idea. You know that something is coming up, and there's like a palpable tension going through the game, and I feel like that's very intentional. So for the van route, that makes sense. It's very like character focused and it's a lot slower pace, but I feel like the balance could have been done a bit better because I really, really enjoyed the plot like beats that happen in the other two routes. But until the very end, you basically don't get much of anything from the van route.
I feel like the same everything for Van's climax, I feel like. It wasn't like first couple acts.
Yeah. I still really enjoyed it. I think the ending is undoubtedly the best in the series. It's the most hype, if nothing else. And one of the things I did mention in the review that I do want to shout out, man, it's crazy to think that a decade ago we were looking at like Falcom just trying to show a cutscene where it's like, here is Laura versus Fee. They are using canned animations and it just looks terrible. And now you look at Kai no Kiseki. Don't actually look up any of the cutscenes. You're going to spoil yourself. But some of the stuff, especially at the end, it's like, oh my God, they went from this being a laughable, like you kind of have to just like grin and bear it part of their games to holy shit. Some of these like moments at the end are genuinely like a strength. They're probably some of the best in like RPGs. And that's not even me being like exaggerating. It's genuinely impressive. Some of the stuff they have at the end and like, even like some of the earlier stuff, it's the presentation's gone a huge buff. I definitely appreciate that. The soundtrack. I didn't really write too much about the soundtrack. There's still some stinkers in it.
The Bit Boss theme from Singo.
I will say this. If I could change literally one thing about how Falcom handles their soundtracks, cut the number of boss themes that Singa handles in half and have him do literally all the environmental themes, it would be better.
He actually does good environmental music, but
yeah,
like bosses are trash.
There's one good boss theme. There's one good boss theme that, but that's basically the one I'll say. But his environmental themes this time are really good. Like the Rainy Day theme is really good, which is also based off the credits theme. The Anchorville theme is genuinely like probably like top five, maybe might be top three songs in that soundtrack for me. I really like the Anchorville theme. But yeah, I think the soundtrack overall, despite some stinkers, is probably the strongest they've had since like Cold Steel 3 or 4.
Yeah, it's a really, really good, there's a lot of really good tracks in Kai. I really latch onto a lot of the, I mean, like you said, there's certainly not great ones, but by and large, way more good than bad.
Yeah,
on that OST, for sure. Definitely a lot of, like, they work really counts, they're, the tracks that are really, really good are deployed at, like, really, really great times. Like, the whole finale of that game, like, the tracks and the score of the finale is, like, spot on. Really, really good stuff.
And credit where it's due. Again, like, that credit theme is genuinely one of the best in the series, and it's like it's Singa. Like, he can do good work. Mm-hmm. Just get him off battle themes, please.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the most, like, the way that game ends is like very one of the most interesting ways I've seen, like, you know, definitely for the whole series. You know, obviously no spoilers, but like it is a gigantic fucking cliffhanger of like. It makes you really. It makes every person who's ever played these games really think. It's like, man, the sky's the limit. Who fucking knows where it's gonna go next?
Yeah. It's like don't believe a single thing about what people say. The status quo is for the next game. We do not know.
No one knows.
Anyone that tells you they know exactly what's gonna happen in the next game is lying, and they probably watched a stream for a game in a language that they don't understand.
That's the best part. I love this one YouTuber that's kind of infamous in the community that kind of calls it, like, oh, this is a nothing happened game. It's like, this fucking guy doesn't understand Japanese. And he's watching like a speedrun.
Yeah, okay. So I'm just going to, since all three of us, we at least have actually experience with this game, like properly. I think that Kai no Kiseki is the most important game in the franchise now, like in terms of lore and like setting up for like actual like details about how, like, what the series is going for, what Zemuria is, and all that sort of thing. I think it's the most important game in the series.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely, because like, it definitely comes into... There are certain events and concepts that have been toyed around with. Yeah, definitely toyed around with, like, mid-Cold Steel and then Reverie, and definitely, like, Daybreak 2. That, like, it feels like all roads lead to what Kai... the concepts that are introduced in Kai.
Yeah, and I feel like it's really, like, if nothing else, the fact that Kai has managed to be relatively cohesive about that is, like, insane. I did not expect to get to this point in the series where it's like, okay, they got to actually start, like, here's where we're going, here's what's up. I was running off the assumption that it was going to be some sort of massive disappointment. Maybe a bit too cynical, but I feel like the way that somehow Kai has threaded the needle. Maybe I'm the only one that feels that way, but it seems like, okay, I see where you're going. I think you're going to stick the landing.
I mean, I hope so, but genuinely, I like Kai a lot. I think it's a really great installment of the game. It's just it's hard. It is definitely, it just sucks that it's that game that's like it takes 40 hours to get good, and that's kind of being charitable to that game. But the first 40 hours of that game are a drag. It is a game that I don't know if I've stated it originally on the podcast when we were talking about Kai, when it first launched. But like my friend said, that summed it up perfectly. That like it is a game where like it is a game for Cold Steel fans that did not play the previous Daybreak games. Like that first 40 hours, it is a major tourism sim in that game where like they reintroduced areas that like, you know, previous Daybreak players have already gone to and know. They reintroduced a lot of characters. Like, why are we reintroducing these characters again? It's because the, you know, Reen's group, for example, are beating these people for the first time. It's just like it's a lot of reusing, reintroduction of like, and it feels like it's like, okay, then. You know, for people who've already played Daybreak, it's like, okay, great.
I don't think I necessarily agree with that personally. It's definitely, like I said, the pacing is not good. But I went into this directly after finishing Daybreak 2, and I didn't feel like it was like...
Retread.
That's fine if you feel that way, but for both of us, we're just like, we're playing through this game, it's like, oh, why are we doing this again?
Yeah, I was getting Azure vibes from the beginning, because it was like trying to like kind of like reset up everything, trying to like get you familiar with this game again. I'm like, it's like, this is the third game in this entree. I should be familiar with the whole thing by now.
Yeah, right? Like the prologue is like, why are we reintroducing these characters again for like the third time, dude?
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing? Like, for me, like if you're cool with that kind of storytelling, that's totally fine. If people are fine reintroducing characters that they've already reintroduced so many times, I get it. That's fine.
Yeah,
I would like stories that already respect your time in that sense of like you should already know we're getting into it. You don't, why are we doing all this setup again?
I definitely agree. I didn't seem like it was like they were going to just. I don't know how to say this in specifically, but it's like I did not get that vibe where it was like they were trying to introduce the cast because they felt like people hadn't played the first two games. I did not get that vibe.
Yeah.
So. I will say, just to comment on a thing that James said earlier about presentation. I've recently played through Daybreak because that's the most recent one in English. And I'm playing through East 10, which, remind me, and it came out 2022 was Daybreak 2, 2023 was East 10.
Yes, East 10 was 2023.
And East 10 still uses, obviously, different series, same developer, uses a lot of those, like, talking about, like, canned animations and some cutscenes that are supposed to be, like, very cinematic. It's like, this doesn't quite pull it off. But then every once in a while, they're like, we're going to have these two characters fight just so we can flex our new engine, and it looks really good. Sometimes I feel like in East 10 specifically, the reasons for it are maybe contrived, but the presentation is still a huge step up. So I'm excited to see that in a Kenseki mindset.
And to be clear, there's still like cutscenes where they're going to use canned animations, but I feel like there's enough of the cutscenes where they use the bespoke animations, and it makes sense when they do, that it really does feel like they were smart with how they allocated that budget for those cutscenes.
Hmm. But yeah, so James put up his write-up for Kaino Koseki, import spoiler-free review. The review itself is as spoiler-free as you can make a review.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not sure if, like, Chow or Josh read it, but I mean, if you did,
I read it.
Yeah, so when I say it's spoiler free, it is spoiler free. It is spoiler free. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and then I'll just bring it up since it's topical. One of the trailers this week was, they called it a story overview trailer for Daybreak 2, obviously coming out in February in English, but it's really just a recap of Daybreak 1, which wasn't that long ago.
I'm pretty sure it's literally the video that you get in both Daybreak 2 and Kai if you want to watch a video to, like, overview what those games' plots were. I'm pretty sure it's the exact same one. They just, for whatever reason,
it's just interesting because it doesn't really cover Daybreak 2, like, story premise at all. It's like, here's what happened. It's like, oh, okay.
Last time on Dragon Ball Z.
I played that in July.
Like, can I start with this one? Ago.
I think so.
Yeah.
Start with whatever one you want.
Yeah. Start with Kai, actually. I heavily recommend.
start with Cold Steel 4.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I have a... It would be interesting to see someone start with Kai, but, man, I could never...
That'd be so sick.
It's like, man, that literally is a game that references every other fucking game in the series. Jesus Christ.
I have one last question on Kai. Just one last question. Does it do the Cold Steel 4 thing where, like, 50 characters enter a room all in a giant arc?
And it's like, oh, I won't say
like, not directly as bad as that, but there are some encounters. There are some encounters.
As good as the ending is, the epilogue, there's, like, one scene in the epilogue where it's like, oh, come on, okay, whatever. You probably know what I'm thinking of, Josh, where it's, mm-hmm. like, right before the credits, where it's like, that is straight out of Cold Steel 4. It's like, who joined the Zoom call?
Yeah.
Fuck. Oh, man.
It was a silly part.
Yeah.
And with that, we'll go into news. Not a lot of news this week. We do have one surprising announcement here, and we'll kind of keep the microphone over in James's corner for this. Aqua Plus, we've had a 30th anniversary event over the last week, and I don't know if there were expectations for announcements at this event or not.
It was expected because like earlier this year they said that they were working on a new Utsuwaru Mono, so we knew that something was in development. And it made sense that it would be like, okay, if you're going to announce it, you have this big, like, fan, like, meetup event thing. And it seems like that would be the best time to announce it. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So what did they announce, James? I'm going to ask you to say it because I can't pronounce it.
Monochrome Mobius 2. But they realized that their ploy to try and get new people into the Utsuwaru Mono series by naming their slight spinoff slash prequel something else did not work, so they were like, we need to have the brand recognition. It's Utsuwaru Mono again, even though it's Monochrome Mobius 2.
So they announced Utsuwaru Mono Shiro Hino Michichi Shirube.
Something like beacons of white or beacons to white, something like that.
And so this was, as far as I can tell, it was a trailer for those that either attended in person or had access to, like, the live stream. And since then, we've gotten the press release from Aqua Plus, but as far as I know, the whatever footage they've shown has not been uploaded yet.
Cam rips have been uploaded.
I mean, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
And like you said, it shows characters in the press release that were introduced in Monochrome Mobius. So this is definitely in that, and which was itself released as a prequel to the Utsuwaru
Series. But there was some things in Monochrome Mobius that made it seem like, okay, is this actually a prequel or is this some sort of, like, rebuild type thing? Because very, very minor things.
Utsuwaru Mono remake.
Yeah. it really is appropriate that we're talking about this right after Trails, because it's like, after the ending for Monochrome Mobius, and the fact that this is a prequel anyways. It's funny how Aquaplus, like, right as we were starting to see the finish line for Trails, it's like, here's a fifth RPG in this series you probably want to be familiar with the Everfort.
That's kind of the nature of these things, you know. After the trilogy for Utabare Rumono, you know, we're all so closely related. It's a natural next step for this series. It's interesting, you know, that they're continuing this. Like, we're gonna start moving away from this heavily visual novel to strategy RPG style and more of this turn-based JRPG style.
Yeah.
I don't know, but how was Monochrome Mobius, like, how visual novel focused was it?
It wasn't very visual novel focused. The main their story was a big focus. The main problem is that it's funny how we were talking about how Kai no Kiseki has bad pacing. Monochrome Mobius, the most interesting aspects of that story are the first 8 hours. Then it's 35 hours of filler. Then there's an ending that leaves off on a cliffhanger that's interesting. And it's like, what was the point of that? I will say that even though I gave this, I think, a 5 or a 6, you could very easily make a sequel that would be an 8 or a 9. Like, yeah. I think that the presentation, besides the NPCs that they had the patch and faces for, was a highlight of it, at least on PC. On PlayStation 5, on the demo.
Oh, I forgot about that NPC thing. Did they fix that? Like, or was that intended?
Yes.
Were they look like shadows or something?
That was intended. Then they patched in faces because enough people were like, that's disconcerting. Please just give them faces.
This might be intended, but I don't get it.
Yeah. Did you ever play the full game or did you just play the demo?
I just played the demo. That's it. I was like, I'm good. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Like, because I would have to read the trilogy, and like I haven't really read the trilogy. I played some of the first game, but then I fell off of it. It's like, it's one of those things, like, I have to really commit myself and I have to be really in the mood for it.
I will tell you what I tell everyone that tries to get into Utabare Rumono. Do not play the first game. Watch the anime, then play the second and third game.
That seems bad.
The anime is a good idea, but the ending, they had to retcon that ending because the ending.
Okay. All you need to know is that the anime is going to say that Hakuro does not fuck. That is not true. He fucks. That is all you need to know. That is all you need to know. But genuinely, I do not think that first game is very noteworthy. I think the second and third game are really good. So if you're just interested in getting into it through the story, just watch the anime. And just know, Hakuaru fucks. And that's all you need to...
But they also made anime adaptations of the
do not,
things after.
Nope, do not watch those. Do not watch those. Don't even think about it.
So which one do we watch and which one do we not?
You watch the first anime.
We need a beginner's guide. So that's a feature idea. Beginner's guide
for you know what? I should actually pitch that, since this is coming out, and if it's like a Monochrome Mobius, it'll probably be a day and date worldwide release.
Oh, remind everyone, how was the Monochrome Mobius? Like, we've talked about this in pre-podcast and I forgot how they released it in the West, but because it was weird. So, like, talk about how they released Monochrome Mobius in the West and how we the projection of this.
Okay. Okay, so Monochrome Mobius came out day and date on PC in the West. Shiravun, who did the PC versions of pretty much all of the Aquaplus titles, they did White Album, they did the Dungeon Travelers games. We're probably going to have a reason to talk about those again when we get to news. But they also did the Utabare Rumono trilogy. They did all three of those. So when Monochrome Mobius was announced, they immediately said, hey, this is coming to PC. We're doing it day and date. And we're also having a English translation day and date. So NIS America did the PlayStation versions like a year and a half later, I think. Something like that. I do not expect NIS America to do... There's inevitably going to be PlayStation versions for this. I'm also going to speculate right now that there's going to be a Switch 2 version of this. Aquaplus is, of course, doing the Utabare Rumono trilogy for Switch early next year. And they were actually, I believe, they were listed under the Nintendo, with one of their recent like PDFs for their earnings releases, actually had a list of developers they consider important. And some of them they just started working with the Switch generation. One of those was Falcom, which I've speculated for a bit. They probably have a Switch 2 dev kit, and that pretty much is as close to a confirmation as we're going to get. But also, I believe, and let me double check this, I believe that actually Aquaplus was one of those. They might not have been. One second. They were not. Okay, never mind.
It's mostly those color buttons that they gave away from those Daybreak
screenshots. Yeah, anyways, that's besides the point. Aquaplus is doing the Utsuwaru Mono trilogy on Switch, so I'm assuming that they're probably trying to target Monochrome Mobius on Switch 2, because to be frank, I do not see how that would have even gotten greenlit if they weren't going to do a Switch 2 version because of how terribly that game bombed in Japan. Okay. The original game. So I think that it's fall next year, probably going to be PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Switch 2, and PC. That would be my assumption. And I would assume that Shiravune... I'm not sure how well the PC version did for them in the long run. I'd have to double check really quickly. So I'd say it's a 50-50 chance that Shiravune does this one day and date. I feel like they probably want to. Okay, 622 reviews. They'll probably do that. That's good enough where they can probably justify it. So it'll probably be day and date on PC in the West. For consoles, that would have to depend on NIS America. And as I've said in previous podcasts, I believe that, well, they've pretty much said, well, some like NIS America, well, NIS American employees have pretty much told me, or as close to have told me, as said, they're trying to get Kaino Kiseki out by the end of next year. They're trying, at least, which means that I don't foresee them doing the console versions of, the new Utsuwaru Mono, because that would just all hands on deck for Kai, especially with how text heavy it is, especially for all the side content. I just don't see them doing it day and date. So it's probably going to be a similar situation with Monochrome Mobius, where it's going to be later than the PC release.
Have we mentioned that Utsuwaru Mono Zan is coming to Steam?
Yeah, yeah, that's coming to Steam.
I was gonna ask for like for the beginner's guide feature. What about these Zan games for people who don't know? Do they touch them at all or not?
No.
That's Shiravune, right?
Yeah, that's Shiravune.
Or no, yeah, so, Shiravune. Yeah. Okay.
So I'm like 99% sure that this will be day and date worldwide on PC at least. So.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of this Nintendo third party publisher slide, you know who is on this slide? Furyu.
Let's go.
And Cygames. Reelink is probably going to be ported to Switch 2. I'm sure they're going to do an expansion for Reelink, and it'll be like, hey, it's coming to Switch 2 day and date with the expansion on other platforms.
But golly, a loss console version.
Oh yeah. Man, the amount of cope.
Oh god, I just realized, imagine years on there.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting stuff. Everyone's still counting the days and making up their fake leaks of like, Nintendo's definitely going to reveal the Switch successor.
From Software's on here.
That's right.
That makes sense. I mean, pretty much everyone and their mom already kind of speculated that it's like Elden Ring's going to be on Switch too. It makes sense.
I was thinking Armored Core. That was partially a joke, but partially not.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we'll see. I mean, yeah, because the Dark Souls games, I forgot Dark Souls 3 came
one,
to Switch.
I thought just one was, I think, on one, Switch.
I don't know if 2 came either, but yeah, I know 1 came to Switch.
Oh, Imagineer makes sense, because I just realized they did the fitness boxing games. And oh, yeah, they did say that they were going to start like trying to make more console games now because of fitness boxing being successful. That's cool. That's cool. Maybe we'll get a new Metarot. Maybe we'll actually get a new one.
Oh Jesus! Don't give me hope.
Yeah. But yeah, I am tentatively excited for this new Utsuwaru Mono game. Even if it ends up not being great, I will play it anyways. But I genuinely think that there's a good chance that this will be a lot better in Monochrome Mobius. I hope so. Like I said, the menuing is the worst I've ever dealt with in an RPG. If they fix that alone, that'll probably bring it up a point or two.
This is also why I'm scared to ever get to start Udawari Ramona, because if I get to Monochrome Mobius, like if you're complaining about menuing in that game, it's probably gonna be 10 times worse for me, because I get ticked off by bad menu in general.
Well, here's the good news about Monochrome Mobius. They took the Falcom approach, where the game wasn't actually really finished when they released it. It took like a month later for them to fix it. I mean, obviously we already knew this because we were talking about the NPC faces. But they improved the run button. They improved load times, I believe. And there's a bunch of other things that they fixed that I don't know off the top of my head. I feel like I should go back and actually like give... That's another idea for a future. I should go back and see, is Monochrome Mobius good now that they've done all these quality of life updates?
Is it good now?
Let's see. 1221 update. Patch notes. Adjusted player movement speed. Improved townsperson NPC visuals. Adjusted monster balance. Modified area maps. Modified tutorial sections. Made some Nuko shrine functionality available anywhere from the system menu, which means that you don't have to go up to a shrine to fast travel. You can fast travel to any shrine from anywhere.
Okay, but where's the bullet point that's improved menuing?
Various minor fixes and adjustments. The system menu is now available directly from the field instead of from the camp menu. 12.2 update, adjusted the dash gauge and some equipment.
I don't think all that quality of life will save that game. I mean, a lot of my friends that played it, they just dropped it because the filler just gotten too bad.
Yeah, like I said, it really is. Like, the first 8 hours, it's like really interesting. And then you get to the point where it's just like, okay... we're twiddling our thumbs for 3-5 hours, and then it's the ending. But yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, we stop time.
Yep.
There were really no other major announcements or trailers for this week. There was a Bloodlines 2 trailer, but it's like focusing on characters like that are part of like the Camarilla. I might be mispronouncing that. The Vampire Court. And I watched it, and I just like found like I couldn't focus. I want to see gameplay more than anything on that, and the character deep dives I'm just not latching onto. But they did release it, and we do have it on the site for those that are interested. Here is one that I'm surprised how quickly they implemented this. I think it was August. Adam, remind me if I have this wrong, but Atlas, up after the release of Shin Megami Tensei V Vengeance, released a poll for like what demons would you like to see added as navigators. So like demons that you could select to follow you in Shin Megami Tensei V. And they just released the patch to the game to add those. So they version 1.03 added 6 new demon navigators to Shin Megami Tensei V Vengeance. And it's a lot of fan favorites. Mara, of course, Mothman, Hellbiker, the Irish name that I can't pronounce. It looks like Fionn Mac, but it's not pronounced that way.
It's like Fionn McCool. Like the cum hail looks, it's just like cool. I don't know. It's not cum hail. That's not how you pronounce it.
Cum hail.
It's not
Irish Gaelic names or whatever that you can't pronounce it. But yeah, so, and then they also added a subquest that adds a new demon. Now, Adam, I remember you and Josh were poking back and forth. Like this demon, Marichi, first appeared in, was it
Strange Journey? It's in 4 and 4 Apocalypse.
Oh. Okay, so in addition to the navigators, which we knew was coming, they just said, here's another new demon that wasn't in Shin Megami Tensei we've had before. So just kind of a fun update, you know, that they're still just kind of giving more content to the game. So Adam, now you got to update your walkthrough and add the new subquest. Figure out when you get it and how to do it.
That's it. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of a weird but cool update, but it's also like, I don't know. I don't think people who have already completed this game, like, I guess completely, like, not like they're gonna go back. Like, all right, I guess I'll. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not worth reinstalling, but it's fun. It's cool.
I kind of wish they just had this out of the box at release, you know. But I get it. at least it's not like it doesn't cost any additional money. It's just like a free edition.
We got I don't think this was announced. We got a surprise update to a PC port from NIS, from Nice America. Phantom Brave.
It's not a surprise
Wait, did you say surprise release?
No, they said they were going to update it.
Sorry. Yeah, it was a surprise update. So
it's a huge amount of updates on that one thing.
Yeah, sorry. Go for it.
Well, I believe the update was a surprise, but maybe it was teased by... So this is Durante, PH3. Obviously, he's worked with NIS America for a lot of their PC ports. These 10 I just talked about. Obviously, all the more recent Kiseki games. But Phantom Brave, the Bermuda Triangle, released on PC back in 2016. And now, like 8 years later, PH3 has basically overhauled the PC port to give it... Anyone who's played a single Durante PC port kind of knows like his style in terms of like UI and format and what he likes to add: arbitrary resolution support, high frame rate support, all those things, ambient occlusion support. So basically they just took a port that, to my understanding, was just fine, bare bones port, and just completely overhauled the Phantom Brave PC port from 8 years ago. So just a cool unannounced
update. Well, I mean, this to provide context to this, because NIS America released the Phantom Brave, the first Phantom Brave, on PS5 earlier on this week, and Durante revealed that PH3 worked on that port that wasn't known, the PS5 port, and then so they basically, it's like, okay, well, we've introduced all these like enhanced features on the PS5 port, so we'll go back and kind of retrofit the old PC port and add in these additions, like more anti-aliasing settings. Restored the UV animations of lava.
There is now three games in the entire world that supports SGSSAA, the best form of anti-aliasing, and all three of them were done by Durante.
Yeah, and also like cool quality, like quality of life stuff. Like when you're selecting on the ability list for your characters in Phantom Brave, some of those abilities will now be color coded based on like the elemental property of that. So like skills that are fire property are now color coded in red. So at a glance, you just know which of your skills are elemental and which of them you want to choose. There's also one of the more fascinating things is there's a dungeon monk NPC on the PSP version of Phantom Brave that wasn't there in the PC version, and that was this NPC was like a shortcut option for rerolling dungeons generated, and the Durante team just entirely rebuilt this NPC and this feature into the PC version of the game. You know, which is, that's, that must be a lot of fucking work to just rebuild that from scratch into the game.
By the way, I do want to clarify one thing.
Yeah.
We did know ahead of time that the PC version was going to be updated. We didn't know precisely how or who or why. I mean, we knew why, PS5 version, but we knew the PC version was getting an update. That was not a surprise.
Yeah, I think they teased that. Yeah, but it's like in a tweet, I believe, just like kind of one off. Mm-hmm.
And it's just cool. Like that's not really, I won't say it's unprecedented, but it's rarer than maybe it should be. Like to have custodians of that sense to like try to say like, yeah, release it on PC and then it's preserved forever. It's like, well, sometimes you need to give it like some TLC, some updates. Then we have versions of games. Square Enix is notoriously bad at this, where it'll release on PS4 and then PS5 and then PC, and well, then each version gets a slight different update.
Kind of on to your point, like Dragon Age Origins is on PC and it's probably not going anywhere. You can buy it and you can play it. It's whether or how well it actually runs and works, and if you need to change it at all. So
ironically enough, like especially for older like PC games, like ones that are, we're talking like 20 plus years old at this point, genuinely, like for games that old, unless they're like very specific, like Japanese games have weird issues with codecs and whatnot, you genuinely have better luck trying to run that shit on like Proton or Wine than modern Windows.
Like, yeah, I'm still waiting for my Knights of the Old Republic 1 update that makes it support widescreen. I'm pretty sure it doesn't support widescreen. Like,
Aspyr updated the 2 like 10 years ago or whatever, and they never got to 1.
Yep. This Phantom Brave update was like it got cool for me because I reinstalled Phantom Brave several weeks ago, and I got through like the first like the tutorials and the stages, but it's like the PC port was like kind of iffy, and like because of that teaser saying, oh, we'll update the PC version, I was like, okay, I'll just hold this off until this update, and I have like it's like a 400 megabyte update that queued into like my Steam downloads for this update. I was like, okay, yeah. I'll probably get, because I do genuinely want to replay the first game before The Last Hero
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually gonna bring up, like, of course, we got Lost Hero coming out in January, so it's topical. Yeah.
January on consoles, the PC versions, like, I think March or something.
I don't know if they dated the PC version yet, but it's sometime after
the console release. I will say, from what I've played of the PS5 version at events, the PS5 version is just fine. It's like 4K 60. So if you have the option of playing it on a PS5, if you don't want to wait, it'll be just fine.
Have a PS5 Pro, you know, enhance that all the way up.
Yeah.
Image boost. Uh-huh.
Maybe I have a buddy of mine who does streaming, and he bought a PS5 Pro and had a stream with a couple buddies of his literally yesterday, where it's like, okay, I'm going to have my buddy's PS5, my PS5 Pro, and I'm going to have them both hooked up to the TV. I'm not going to tell them which is which. I'm going to see if they can even tell the difference.
That's awesome.
There were some games where the PS5 Pro version was worse. Silent Hill 2 Remake on PS5, I'm assuming because they added in ray tracing or whatnot, the internal resolution is lower. This is an assumption. So, or there's like no denoising on the ray tracing. So you look at it and it's like, it just looks worse, because like you start up the game, you're looking at like the puddles on the road next to the car, and it's like on the regular PS5, like you have issues with FSR upscaling and whatnot. But the PS5 Pro, it is just constantly just, it doesn't know what to do because of like the ray tracing, I'm assuming. It's like, if anyone's listening and hasn't actually like used ray tracing in a game before, one problem with low quality ray tracing that isn't properly denoised is that the global illumination or reflections or whatnot are just constantly kind of like not sputtering, but you know what I mean, right, Josh?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I've seen
that. So it was like just like that, and because of the lower internal resolution, just like, oh, that, like, they were wondering if it's like, is it raining? Is that why the puddles are looking like that? It's like, no, it's not raining. So. But there were some games that had massive improvements. Obviously, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Funnily enough, College Football 2025, which they tried, it doubles the frame rate.
That's funny.
But
I think that, I mean, that is definitely like the big test case scenario is the FF7 Rebirth, because they have a new versatility mode graphics option that they added that kind of combines the best of both worlds, where you get like you know, the 60 FPS experience of like even better than quality mode visuals.
Yeah. But for example, like Spider-Man 2 and Ratchet and Clank, it was basically a coin flip whether or not they could tell. And like my friend, he's very technically minded. He was able to tell barely, and he was pretty confident in it. But the two people he was testing, they guessed. They straight up guessed. They did not know.
I would guess. I mean, fuck yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pretend I know.
Yeah, it's...
The only one I'd probably get right is like FF7 Rebirth. That's
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you would be able to tell if College Football was running at 60
FPS. Okay, yeah, for sure. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Dragon's Dogma 2 apparently looks a lot better.
Okay.
And the other one that was really noticeable is the Dead Rising Deluxe Remaster adds in like reflections, like ray trace reflections. So it's like, okay, that was obvious because you go up to a glass door or a window and you see a reflection. It's like, at first they thought that they just didn't notice in on the other one. Then they go back and it's like, nope, that is obviously the PS5 Pro. So.
That's good.
But yeah,
I'll just my takeaway is I'll wait for the PC version of Rebirth to play it and get cool frame rate and visuals together.
Yep.
I'm not in a, but it's kind of, I guess more broadly speaking, I guess PS5 Pro does kind of lay the groundwork of like moving forward, like, you know, more, you're going to see a lot more of these like machine learning upscale technologies like on the next generation of consoles whenever
Microsoft,
I think even Nintendo, like the some of the rumors or the Switch's successors, like they might have some form of DLSS.
It's gonna have some form of DLSS. They even tried to get a patent for their form of using hardware accelerated machine learning upscaling.
So they'll just have, like, you know, their own acronym. Like, you know, we have the Pisser with the PlayStation. Who knows what Nintendo will have? The
such a dumb.
That's probably the one thing about the PS5 Pro that elicits any sort of joy in me, is it's like they actually went for that acronym. They had fun with it.
I'm sorry, but like it's forever the Pisser to me. That's what it is. It's a PSSR. I'm going to say Pisser.
Yeah.
And on the theme of just game updates, this is a pretty minor update compared to the other ones, but Lords of the Fallen, which released last October, which has had a whole roadmap of updates that developer CI Games and Hexworks have, like, really kind of, to my outside perspective, knocked the ball out of the park. They're continuing to do that. It just got a new update, 1.6, that continues to tweak and add, like, fan feedback for, like, enemy density and things like that. Some tweaking of one of the areas in the game, I forget, the Umbral Realm, like the difficulty curve was kind of weird, and they tweaked how that ramps up. One thing I thought was interesting is, I guess there's a boss in like the tutorial area called the Light Reaper that they decided is no longer there on New Game Zero, like original game, but will show up on New Game Plus. I'm trying to imagine, like, what was the Light Reaper doing to have him remove him from the new game experience? If you know, comment, because I don't know. Like,
it might be just like a really, like, super, like, hard boss battle, especially on a fresh new playthrough character on there, and like people just like got hung up and it's like, okay, I'm not gonna move from the tutorial area until I beat this boss, you know. And maybe they have like internal statistics like, we don't want people to get hung up on the tutorial area because of this super difficult boss that we put in.
Not quite the same, but like Dark Souls 3, I think his name is like Gunder. Like, he's not hard, but he's a test right at the beginning. So I'm imagining that only like super tuned up, and it's like, oh, I haven't learned the game yet.
I was pretty sure I knew which boss that was, and I looked up a video to double check. Yeah, I don't even know why they removed it, because it's one of those things where it's like, not even like the Asylum Demon, but rather the the opening boss for Demon Souls, where it's like, you're not really supposed to kill it. You like die, and then it's like, it just doesn't show up again. So, I mean, I don't even know why they removed it, but I guess whatever.
Yes, I don't know.
Yeah. I will say that I'm not sure. I don't think I'm going to go back and play this again, because I did genuinely enjoy what I played of Lords of the Fallen. I beat it. Genuinely, I think it's one of my favorite Souls likes, and the issues I had with it were mostly down to enemy density in the last couple of areas. And I'm pretty sure when Junior reviewed it, he had the same thoughts. So it feels like it's probably in a much better state now.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, like, just just the commitment to making this game better and better for people is like kind of outstanding on the devs. I feel like we say that every time. Maybe bring up, like, you know, a new update for Lords of the Fallen.
It's a shame that we already know that the next game is going to be an Epic Games exclusive.
Forgot about that.
Why would you do this?
Not good. Not good.
Dumbasses.
I think the most amusing patch note here in this update is the simplified first jump tutorial bullet. In their words, we refined the jump tutorial to be more accessible. Hands up in the comments if you cleared it on the first attempt. So whatever the first jump tutorial was, they're like, that's clearly too difficult for people. We've simplified it. So
I'm imagining looking at their internal metrics and they're being like, did you know that like 50% of people die at the jump tutorial? And they're like, what do we do?
That's funny. So, I mean, yeah. Cool update. Sure.
We have a couple sales updates this week. Kingdom Come Deliverance, of course, has a sequel coming out next February. The original game has sold 8 million units. Earlier this year, it was reported that they had sold 6 million units. Of course, this is one thing I forgot, but the Switch port released in March. I forgot this came to Switch. So with the help of the Switch port, Kingdom Come Deliverance has sold between 1 and 2 million copies this year. And
I also imagine that, like, just the announcement of the sequel as well, and it getting closer and closer, is also bumping up sales as well across all platforms. It's like, hey, I want to get in on it.
And I think it's had, like, some really good bundles on Steam. And I'm not saying that doesn't count. Like, oh, it's got a $15 bundle. That means it'll... Like, no. Like, it's a... I don't know what you call that, like a legacy title, not legacy, but it's a catalog title Let's see what it is.
Steam. I don't know if I mentioned this in the podcast, but they also uploaded like Kingdom Come Deliverance, the cutscene, the movie on YouTube.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So like, yeah. I played the game. It's been a while. Before I played 2, which Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, I may not play at launch because 1, it's releasing in a busy month. 2, Deliverance at launch is really buggy, so maybe I'll wait. But like, hey, I might just set aside a night and watch all the cutscenes again just to kind of refresh what happened. Because it's been like a
10-hour movie, isn't it?
It's a lot. 7 hours?
I mean, that's pretty common. Like, a lot of fans have uploaded all Kingdom Hearts cutscenes, all whatever. Right. But like, it's rare to see it from like officially uploaded.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but when is Falcom going to do hour for the cutscenes throughout all Kiseki games to get people ready for the final game?
500 hours. That's not even an exaggeration. I'm pretty sure that would be below the number that they would have to do at that point.
Yeah, here's just a cutscene digest of all the games, all the main story scenes, side quest scenes, and the optional interaction scenes.
Yeah, 5 hours long story.
Everyone get their popcorn and be seated here for the rest of your life.
And you'll love Hunt Henry by the end of it.
There you go. We also got the Q2 results from Nintendo. And the big update here is the first sales update for Echoes of Wisdom. Sold 2.6 million units. And for some context, the Link's Awakening remake sold 3.1. So slightly cooler than Link's Awakening remake from 2019, but in the same ballpark. Adam, I don't know if there was any other like interpretations, like deeper in the results, like for the other games or catalog titles.
So I pay attention to a lot of like fiscal results stuff. Nintendo and Capcom are nice because they release basically any game that sells more than a million. They'll give you basically exactly here's how many we've sold, or more specifically shipped to stores. But so every quarter there's usually one Nintendo game that we're interested in that we'll cover. Like last quarter it was Paper Mario, now it's Echoes of Wisdom. For the next result we're going to see Brothership, and then the results after that we'll see Xenoblade Chronicles Cross Definitive Edition results. So it's kind of nice to see that Nintendo does that versus a lot of other companies will just say like this game is doing well. And they don't say much, or like Square Enix will barely say anything. So it's nice that Nintendo actually gives the number.
They'll be like it underperforming, but within reasonable expectation. Or they'll like kind of like say both sides. You're like, wait, so is it, which one is it? At least me reading it, sometimes that's the impression I get.
So Square Enix released their results. They're losing money on HD games again. Remember how they barely made a profit last quarter? Yeah, they're losing money again, which they have.
Surprise.
They have for like at least 2 years on that segment, sub-segment. Dawn Trail, big boost to their MMO segment. I don't know. It's definitely earning more money now. I don't know if it's earning as much as they wanted, but it's definitely a big boost to their series. Mobile games for Square Enix are still making money, but they're not making as much money. So again, it's like, that's probably not the direction they want to go.
It's also kind of a weird thing because they've announced closures to a bunch of those mobile games too. So it's like you're earning less because you're cutting off revenue stream.
But yeah, they obviously released Ever Crisis like a year ago ish, right? Like last September. And then they have Ember Storia coming out, which
that's right.
That's their. I think that's the only game coming out that's not already out. Anyways, it'll be interesting to see what Square Enix does for this quarter, which has they had like a couple of I guess the PC ports were technically last quarter, September. So this quarter being October, November, December, they have Romancing Saga, they have Dragon Quest, they have Fantasian. So we'll see if we get anything on any of those. Also, Sega put out their numbers. They are, for the first quarter, the first half of the year, they are above expectations in digital entertainment, despite they say that the quarter one new games sales were more sluggish being their word, than they expected. And that would have been Super Monkey Ball and Shin Megami Tensei V Vengeance. So kind of as a group, those games seemingly aren't doing as well as they would have hoped. However,
it
they
doesn't
do...
count Metaphor.
No, Metaphor would be next quarter.
How about the would that have counted the new Infinite Wealth?
That would have been last year.
Last one? Okay.
They did mention by name, catalog sales are up. Catalog sales usually mean like games that are released in previous quarters, specifically Unicorn Overlord. So Unicorn Overlord, they state by name as having basically selling well, having legs after its launch. So
yeah,
that's good.
That makes sense. It was like the quickest that, and well, the fastest that any VanillaWare game hit 1 million copies sold. So it's like,
Someone at Sega convinced VanillaWare to fucking release these things on PC. I don't know what you have to do, but
you gotta
somehow convince them.
Yeah,
man.
It's like we live in a world where the latest VanillaWare game, as far as we can tell, may or may not have outsold the latest Star Wars game, and that's kind of insane to me.
Now that is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, shit. Fuck.
Now Sega also basically said, Metaphor is off to a great start, but we don't actually get like the results for that like concretely until next quarter, because that's an October release. So
I think it covers us for sales, so we'll start to wrap up and go into some dates. New Arcline, which is kind of like a there's got to be a genre for like magic technology punk,
steampunk. Retro steampunk-ish.
Magic tech punk.
It's magic.
Magic tech punk.
There's probably a better word for it, but it's a CRPG from, I think, a new developer, Dreammate. It's releasing an early access in late November, November 26th.
This is a weird one because it's early access on PC only. It's eventually going to come to consoles. This they weren't, I guess, planning on early access initially. And they only decided to do it because of all the feedback that they got on the Steam Next Fest demo several weeks ago. You know, and the state of that piece, Steam Next Fest demo off the bat, was like it was very heavily unoptimized. And they eventually released patches to optimize the demo and so forth. And, you know, aside from like all the feedback that people have gotten, like, you know, where they think what was good about it, what was bad about it, etc. So they got so much feedback that they're like, we should just launch this in early access first before fully launching it on PC and consoles, because I think that was their initial plan, which was a full release on PC. It's kind of interesting because their early access is going to be priced at a heavily discounted rate, like at $20 USD in Euro, before raising it in the full release. And it's only going to have like a quarter of the main storyline, and then most of the updates coming to it is going to be more side content, side quests, and so for side activities. So it's good on them, you know, for making that decision, but it must have not been an easy decision to make. But, you know, hopefully they're going to work alongside the community to make it, you know, the best it could be before its full launch. So, you know, good luck to them, and hopefully that goes well for them. That's really cool.
It always makes you wonder, like, what's the game, Adam, that went into early access just like in January? Like sometimes these games go into early access and I just like forget that they exist, but clearly it's been successful.
No Rest like, for the Wicked, maybe?
Greedfall 2.
Greedfall 2. Oh, got it.
Yeah, so like it went into early access and then I just kind of stopped thinking about it. So like I hope they're getting the feedback that they want. I hope players are like helping or people that are really excited. Like, I hope it's not doesn't just go in early access just to got kind of be forgotten. But just because we don't see it doesn't mean that obviously they're not working on it. But basically, I hope this works out for them. There have been success stories, plenty of them in early access. Though, of course, there have been plenty of games that never make it out of early access. So we hope for the best for New Arcline, but it'll be playable. About a quarter of the story at the end of the month.
It's for people like it's also kind of like a good thing. Like, you know, before it fully launches, you can kind of pick it up for $20 before it fully launches as well. Whenever. It comes out, so already a deal.
Speaking of early access, Path of Exile 2 was originally planning to launch in early access on November 15th. They've recently pushed it back to December 6th. The game director, Jonathan Rogers, says the delay was to make sure that no one lost anything they paid for and nothing in the account system is broken, because they're going to be keeping Path of Exile 1 and 2 like up in parallel. I don't know if this is related to that, but it's a little bit more specific of a reason rather than just like polish or making sure they're ready. But I guess they just wanted an extra 3 weeks to just make sure that they don't have anything that they can't fix on people's accounts for PathXL.
Yeah, a lot of my friends are hurting because they were really, really looking forward to early access launching on November 15th, but now, you know, they have to wait a little bit more.
They weren't those players that took their PTE off and then...
Yeah, I mean, they even apologized for it because they're very earnest in their apology for delaying it, and like, you know, because they know that people like already filed PTO in advance and not to move it again, you know, kind of, you know, always a little bit shady. On that end, so you know, they're very apologetic and very transparent. And like, I think this is the right move because this is very, very sensitive stuff on like making sure that people's accounts are properly migrated over. Because all the microtransactions that people have bought in Path of Exile 1 is also coming to Path of Exile 2, and it's going to be applicable there. So people don't have to pay extra or double or anything that people paid for in Path of Exile 1. All the microtransactions are cosmetic. Not all. There's like, you know, stash tabs, for example, for your inventory. Like that stuff is also being migrated into Path of Exile 2. And they want to like make doubly sure that, like, as you know, Brian was summarizing for it, is like no one loses anything. And if people have issues with it, they're in a position to help them out. But they're trying to get this as right as they can on the first pass to it. And there's also, you have to account for. There are going to be people who play Path of Exile 1 and Path of Exile 2 both at the same time. Just like, you know, one is off-season, but another's on-season. So they're like going switching back and forth. And whatever they pay for has to be also applied to the other game as well. So, you know, you have to account for those people who are going to be playing both of these games, you know, in tandem with each other and making sure that it works for them.
And it's kind of a paradigm that we've not seen a lot of developers try. Usually, like, sometimes the first game will stick around, but to be officially supported in the way that the Path of Exile devs are doing it is, I wish them well, because, like, I know some people didn't really want to make the move to Overwatch 2 or Destiny 2 or Guild Wars 2, and the first game is still around, but usually is kind of in maintenance mode and not supported, and then eventually just kind of no longer is looked at by the devs. So hopefully this is a success to make sure that they, because that's just two revenue streams for them. They can keep their current population of players, and then hopefully bring in new players or transfer some players over from 1 to 2. And I'm interested, as not a fan of Path of Exile, but it's like a just kind of interested to see how it plays out.
Yeah, because they have two different teams. They have one different team for Path of Exile 1 and another different team internally for Path of Exile 2. So like, you know, the Path of Exile 1 is going to keep on doing what it's been doing, which is like, you know, they have their leagues, you know, for several weeks, and then Path of Exile 2 is also going to have that structure. But it seems like, you know, the campaign in Path of Exile 2, they like in an interview with Shuhei Yoshida in a YouTube video, was like they're expecting the campaign of Path of Exile 2 to like last around 50 hours, they said, which is significantly a big step up from 1. Like, like going through 1's campaign is already like maybe like 20, 25 hours-ish. And I guess 2 is going to be like at least double that, it seems.
And then for one more December release, this was announced back in the summer, but the previous Japanese Vita-only game, Tokyo Clan Pool, was announced to come over as a worldwide release on PC and Switch. Back in the summer, it was originally going to be coming to Steam. They've announced that it'll be coming on December 19th, but it will no longer be releasing on Steam. It'll be releasing on GOG.
And I believe people who have been following this on like the Steam database has basically, you know, on the updates on the Steam database entry for Tokyo Clan Pool, like, yeah, they banned the game off of Steam, which is now why it's coming to GOG.
Does it have like ecchi elements or something in it?
Ecchi? Not really. It's not
ecchi. Sorry.
There are some like some light ecchi outfits, but it's very, very light compared to like, you know, something like in Dungeon Travelers. But this also got an ESRB rating for Vita as well.
So there have been a couple. I think like Dungeon Travelers, which seems to be pretty skeevy in places. I know it has a Vita version, but like it was relegated to Joe Rin of all places, as like they sell porn games, right? This game is not Joran, but GOG, and also Switch. And it's like, you can release on GOG and Switch, but not Steam?
It's not, that seems it's weird. Not the first time, because there is a very critically acclaimed VN called Muramasa, Full Metal Demon Muramasa.
Yeah, I talked about that,
Yeah, that got banned on Steam, but it's available on GOG. Like I just said, it's like, it's...
It's just the next casualty.
Yeah, how many times can we talk about this without, like, we can keep going on and on and on about it, but it just doesn't change the fact that this is, like, absolutely ridiculous. It could, I don't know. Now, I made a joke on Blue Sky where it's like, we don't know how things are going to go in the next couple of years. Maybe. There might be some federal laws that might actually make it so that what Valve's doing now might be federally required. So if that happens, then I'll stop giving them shit. But it's like, as of right now, it's like, just not good.
It, like from outsiders' perspectives, it just feels like, you know, these somewhat in Valve, like an employee or something, is just like arbitrarily dismissing them because they don't like the anime or anime girl aesthetic. Or something. Just, you know, from outsiders to say, we don't actually know what's going on internally and what's the exact process. We you know, James has talked to a few developers behind the scenes and publishers, like, you know, on how that process is. But it's like, it's very unclear. And like, even some publishers are like, you know, at least baffled, but like, you know, they have no control over it because they don't want to speak. They don't want to put themselves out there for it because they want to maintain that relationship with Steam. Because if Valve decides to abolish their relationship with them, that really it cripples them a lot because Steam is a big part of their, you know, infrastructure and their release plans. So it's always just a tricky thing to talk about and a tricky thing to like find solutions for. It's just it sucks. It's one of those things like, well, we just have to deal with it because Valve is such a juggernaut in space.
And it's just like, there's from an outsider's perspective, there's so much like garbage shovelware, mock games on Steam that this is what they cracked down on. It just seems like I'm sure there's some rationale behind it, but it's not apparent. But yeah, it'll at least be coming out on GOG, so at least they were able to pivot into that sense and make it available as a worldwide PC release in that sense, and also on Switch, December 19th. So it was previously Vita and Japan exclusive, so still cool that we'll get to play it in just over a month. And with that, we've covered all the news and all the games for this episode of the TetraCast. Obviously, we don't slow down. Next week, we'll go straight into Dragon Quest III HD 2D, which I know a lot of people have had circled on their calendar for a while. And of course, I know lots of people are still playing through. I'm still playing through East 10. Saga and all the other games that are coming out in January, like Phantom Brave.
Yeah, I'm like 19 hours of the new Dragon Age now, so I'm working through that.
Yeah, I want to get to that eventually too. Oh yeah, I guess I should call out. We mentioned it when he was on the podcast, but Josh Valentino has been putting out a bunch of Dragon Age Veilguard guides. Yeah. So if you've been playing that, go ahead and bookmark a few of those if they've been useful for you, and leave us comments or ratings if they have been. You can listen to this TetraCast on pretty much all the podcast services. If you listen to us and you've made it to the end of the podcast, thank you so much. We do appreciate it. Give us a comment, a rating, a like. If there's anything we could be doing better, let us know. We like to read those. You can find RPG Site on all the social media networks, including Blue Sky. Now we are there. We're trying to cross post to Twitter, Facebook, Blue Sky whenever we can. So give us a follow if you're over there. And join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite, or hit the link at the top of the homepage. Or just leave a comment on this podcast post on our website. We'll read it there too. We'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to you all next week.
The Erdrick Trilogy.
Podcast is not even 2.5 hours. Short.
Holy shit.
Short.
It's a miracle.